During the Six-Day War between Israel and the Arab nations, the USS Liberty was sent by Johnson to collect electronic intelligence in the eastern Mediterranean. The clearly marked U.S. intelligence ship was 14 miles off the coast of Israel in international waters. Israeli surveillance aircraft flew low over the ship and clearly identified it as an American vessel. At 2 p.m. that afternoon, the USS Liberty was attacked by three Mirage III fighter bombers. From the onset of the attack, the fighter bombers were jamming U.S. signals. Not only were they jamming U.S. signals specifically, they were also unmarked. Fighter bombers strafed the ships with their cannons, dropped conventional munitions and napalm on the ship, repeatedly from stem to stern. After the Mirages had done their work, the ship was hit by medium bomber Dassault missiles, carrying napalm and other munitions like white phosphorus. The USS Liberty was then attacked by three Israeli torpedo boats bearing Israeli flags. Then the torpedo boats began strafing life rafts in the water, an international war crime. While all of this was happening, the oversized American flag flew clearly above the ship. The attack on the Liberty went on for hour after hour after hour. During the entire attack, the USS Liberty continually called the Sixth Fleet that was nearby, begging for air support or rescue. Two aircraft carriers in the Med responded by launching fighter aircraft. Unbelievably, they were recalled by the White House. Rear Admiral Geis, then commanding the carriers in the Sixth Fleet, called Washington personally to confirm the recall order. Secretary of Defense McNamara came on the line, and then President Johnson himself told Geis, "I want that goddamn ship going to the bottom. No help. Recall the wings." Imagine being Admiral Geis begging the president to allow you to defend an American ship that's under attack and being told by him that he wants the ship going to the bottom.
Take what's there, 'cause finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about the revolution.
The Liberty attack happened on June 8, 1967, and you're listening to This Week in Radical History, produced especially for you from the mobile fortress of Glee Glee Studios. Inspiration for this ditty came from the Slingshot organizer, and some radical info can be found at the People's Calendar at the Daily Bleed website. Again this week, some audio is being gently lifted from the Radio Roots crew at WBAI in New York and the Neighborhood Network of Columbus, Ohio.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes.
This Week in Radical History for June 8th, in 1806, the Founding Fathers most conservatives like to forget and barely talk about in the history textbooks, Thomas Paine dies in obscurity on this date. He was a revolutionary, radical writer and inventor, and this Founding Father would have a whole 10 people escorting his coffin on his death. To this day, no one really sure where his remains are. Author of The Rights of Man and Age of Reason, his radical thoughts included the following on religion. Quote, "I do not believe in the creed professed by the Jewish Church, the Roman Church, the Greek Church, by the Turkish Church, by the Protestant Church, nor any church that I know of. My own mind is my own church. All national institutions of churches, whether Jewish, Christian, or Turkish, appear to me no more than human inventions set up to terrify and enslave mankind and monopolize power and profit." Thomas Paine. Also on a state in Wisconsin news in 1867, Frank Lloyd Wright, master builder, lives in Richland Center. Wright admired the anarchist Potemkin, who would stay with him while visiting in Chicago. As a review of Wright's FBI file revealed, the Fed's interest in the architect expanded far beyond his pacifism. Hoover's men recorded his involvement with the Wobblies, his continuing attempts to combat the U.S. government's dehumanization of the Japanese during and after the war, his rebel-rousing speeches on college campuses, his works in international socialism and third world governments. Hoover's snoops, however, was only a minor irritant compared to the real damage done by the Federal Housing Authority, which routinely denied financing rights projects, and the U.S. Federal Home Loan Association also refused to underwrite mortgages of Wright's homes. Let freedom ring. Also on June 8, 1904, battle between the Colorado militia and striking mine workers in Dunnville ends with 6 Union members dead and 15 taken prisoner. 79 of the strikers were also deported to Kansas, courtesy of Rockefeller, who owns the state government and militia. Rockefeller following the Golden Rule: if you have the gold, you get to rule. Rockefeller's bought and paid for sheriff would say about the lack of rights offered to the arrestees, habeas corpus, hell, we'll give him postmortems.
And in 1972, it was the United States' turn for an allegedly accidental bombing, this time in Vietnam, where U.S. supplied and armed and guided South Vietnamese planes dropped napalm on a group of civilians fleeing a rural village near Saigon, which had just been attacked by U.S. warplanes. A lone photographer happened to capture several images of the civilian survivors, which included a 9-year-old girl, Pen Tai Kim Puk, who had stripped off her burning clothes and yet sustained life-threatening burns on her upper body. That photograph, which won a Pulitzer Prize, was published in American newspapers and helped fuel anti-war sentiments among a majority of Americans. And those are just some of the events in world history that took place on this day, June 8th. This Day in History is a production of the Neighborhood Network in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis.
Lastly, for June 8th in 1990, Guatemala, U.S. citizen Michael Devine, kidnapped and murdered by CIA-paid military officials, led by School of America's two-time graduate, Colonel Julio Alperez. This week in radical history, for June 9th, 1623, New World shenanigans. On negotiating a treaty with the Potomac River tribes, the Indian chief and 200 of his followers dropped dead from poison wine. And they are the savages. More New World news not read about in your textbooks. Thomas Morton is the first person deported from the New World on this date in 1628. The Puritan colonists did not like Morton's more native-friendly and more successful Marymount colony, where they dared to treat native peoples with dignity and dared to dance around a maypole from time to time. So the Puritans kicked Morton out and burned the colony to the ground. Yeah, so our country is so much built on religious freedoms. More terrible Native American news in 1863, Nez Perce Reservation, Idaho, was reduced to one-tenth of its original size to accommodate white settlers and railroad interests.
And in 1957, the final blow was dealt to the anti-communist campaign of Senator Joseph McCarthy's House Un-American Activities Committee, which had wrecked the lives and careers of thousands of America's promising artists and professionals by accusing them of belonging to or sympathizing with the Communist Party. A number of prominent intellectuals refused to comply with the committee, including singer-actor Paul Robeson, and historian William Mandel, who told the committee members they were insane. On this day in 1954, an army lawyer, Joseph Welsh, reacted to the committee's interrogation by asking McCarthy on live television, quote, "Have you no shame?" 1 week later, the U.S. Senate passed a resolution denouncing McCarthy. And those are just some of the events on world history that took place on this day, June 9th.
On this day, June 10th in 1692, the first victim of the Salem witch trials in the Massachusetts Bay Colony was executed by hanging. Bridget Bishop had been accused of witchcraft when the daughters of a local minister began to have periodic nervous fits, and their father believed them to be possessed by evil spirits. Under interrogation, the girls claimed that Bishop and later others in the small Puritan town had cast spells on them, and the provincial magistrates obliged by placing the accused on trial. In all, 13 men and women were sent to the gallows, and one man, a farmer by the name of Giles Corey, was crushed to death by having large stones piled upon his chest.
Again, not in your history books, but on this date in 1871, American military forces land in Korea. They'll be back years later. The only thing ever good to come out of the Korean War, the TV show MASH. As I said in that show, war never ends. They've just taken it on the road.
And you can do the same thing if you please.
On or around this day in 1899, federal troops were sent from Texas to the town of Wardner, Idaho, whereupon they arrested virtually every male citizen they could find and placed them in several stockades. This was in response to a miners' protest, which had resulted in several armed conflicts and the dynamiting of the Bunker Hill Mill Works in Wardner 2 weeks earlier. The protests began when the rail barons raised their fees for transporting mine ore, and the mine owners tried to cover the expense by cutting the miners' pay and increasing their hours. With over 1,000 miners and other townsfolk corralled in a guarded stockade with no sanitation and only minimal provisions, the Union efforts in the region were effectively crushed.
This week in radical history for June 11, 1898 in Cuba. U.S. Marines land in Guantanamo Bay during the Spanish-American War and decide it would be a great place for the military to imprison, interrogate, and torture prisoners and not have to answer to U.S. constitutional laws.
On this day, June 11th in 1913, the United States General Pershing, who was placed in charge of the U.S. occupation forces in the Philippines, launched an assault on a group of some 500 Filipino Muslims who had sought refuge in the crater of an extinct volcano known as Budbagsak, killing almost the entire group, including many women and children. The Philippine Muslims were among the most determined resistors to the American occupation and were known for their use of suicide attacks, but the Americans in the Philippines were far more brutal, often massacring entire villages and committing other atrocities. There is evidence that Pershing was generally less inhumane than the previous commander in his suppression of the Philippine resistance, but he considered this particular group, which declined all diplomatic overtures and coercion, to be a potential threat, and so no lives were spared.
Also for June 11, 2002, Earth First activists win $4.4 million in false arrest suit against Oakland police and FBI. They were originally charged with bombing their own car. No one has ever held
the FBI
responsible for the bombing.
On this day, June 12th, in 1963, U.S. civil rights leader Medgar Evers was assassinated in the driveway of his Jackson, Mississippi home by white supremacist vigilante Byron De La Beckwith. Evers was a World War II veteran who had participated in the Allied invasion at Normandy. He began working with the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, or the NAACP, in the early 1950s after he was denied access to the polls by a white mob. Evers also challenged the segregationist policies at Mississippi State University, which at that time did not admit African Americans. Evers' murderer, who was an active member of the Ku Klux Klan, was tried and acquitted twice by all-white juries, then finally convicted in 1994 after new evidence suppressed during the original trial was uncovered. And in 1982, a gigantic march and rally, the largest ever in U.S. history, converged in New York City's Central Park to demand the elimination of nuclear weapons worldwide. Fully 1.25 million people jammed into the park's largest open field and an adjacent field to hear speakers and musicians, including actor Orson Welles in one of his last public appearances, Pete Seeger, Rita Marley, Bruce Springsteen, Mario Cuomo, Helen Caldicott, James Taylor, Jackson Brown, Linda Ronstadt, and more. The rally was held in conjunction with the United Nations Special Meeting on Disarmament. 1 month later, President Ronald Reagan withdrew the United States from negotiation for an international treaty banning the testing of nuclear weapons, and the following year he proposed the development of a space-based network of allegedly defensive nuclear missiles called the Strategic Defense Initiative. And those are just some of the events in world history that took place on this day, June 12th.
On this day, June 13th, in 1971, the New York Times began publishing selections from the Pentagon Papers, a top-secret document entitled The History of U.S. Decision-Making in Vietnam. The papers publicly revealed the lies told by the government surrounding the Vietnam War and the true nature of U.S. foreign policy in Vietnam. The public exposure of this information infuriated and humiliated President Nixon. Recognizing that the document threatened to further erode public support for the long and costly war, he imposed a censorship order, which was later overridden by the Supreme Court.
And on this day in 2002, the United States formally withdrew from a previously binding anti-ballistic missile treaty with the Russian Federation of Former States of the Soviet Union. The treaty had been negotiated between the U.S. and the Soviet Union under the Andropov administration, and shortly thereafter, U.S. President Ronald Reagan initiated the so-called Strategic Defense Initiative, or STAR Wars plan to place U.S.-controlled weapons in space. The Soviets and many Americans argued that this violated the treaty. After the dissolution of the Soviet Union, when Russia drafted a memorandum of understanding to reaffirm the treaty, then U.S. President Clinton declined to present it to the U.S. Senate, thus setting the stage for his successor, George Bush, to nullify the treaty unilaterally. The United States remains the only nation in the world to have used nuclear weapons so far, and the Bush administration consistently refused to rule out a unilateral nuclear strike. And those are just some of the events in world history that took place on this day, June 13th.
On this day, June 14th, in 1775, the Continental Army was formed in order to fight the American Revolutionary War. Although it was disbanded after the war in favor of state militias, its descendant, the U.S. Army, was formed by Congress 9 years later. Today, the U.S. Army has become the largest branch of America's armed forces and uses aggressive recruiting tactics to attract more soldiers. Opponents of the Army's recruitment strategies claim that they are manipulative and deceitful, and that they target working-class communities by offering benefits that many low-income people are otherwise denied. These military contracts often have catches, and they are also unilateral, meaning the military can alter the contents at any time. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Only a couple more items for June 14th, 1855, more Wisconsin news. Fighting Bob La Follette lives, pursued public policies to improve the lot of farmers, workers, children, and women. Also on this date in 1917, anarchist and feminist Emma Goldman ignores death threats and speaks at anti-conscription meeting chaired by her pal Alexander Berkman, who also speaks. Police would raid and arrest all men of draft age who could not show proof of registration. Also on June 14, 1928, in Argentina, Che Guevara, Cuban guerrilla, lives. Argentine doctor who reject both capitalism and orthodox communism.
Playa Girón es la primera derrota del imperialismo en América Latina, pero también es una de las primeras derrotas del imperialismo en escala mundial.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح من مخيم إلى بلد مهجر من مخيم إلى بلد مهجر تسكله ماسا لون وطن تسكله ماسا لون وطن نفقا لعودة اللاجئين لعودة اللاجئين وفراش المنفى من شتات
لماذا تركت الحصاد وحيدا لماذا تركت WZBC Newton, and we will now continue with This Week in Palestine.
Good morning, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice, that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This is John Roberts. We have a full feature presentation this morning, and so have to get right to it. In November of 2015, there was a conference at Boston University sponsored by Students for a Just Peace in Palestine, that featured Normal Finkelstein and Muin Rabbani, who have co-authored a book together and who both spoke at the conference. Unfortunately, we cannot offer both presentations in one broadcast. Time will not permit, but we want you to hear both scholars, so we'll have Muin Rabbani this week and Norman Finkelstein next week. It is the only way we can do it. We begin with Normal Finkelstein introducing Muin Rabbani at Boston University.
Thank you for coming out this evening. And by good fortune for myself, and I think especially good fortune for you, the audience, by coincidence, my co-author, who I only get to see once every several years, he happened to be in Boston at the same time as me, which is tonight. And a few months ago, we decided that maybe now was the time to not only talk about the awful things that have been happening in Israel-Palestine, but there may actually be the opportunity now to talk about how, for once and for all, to resolve the conflict and to put it behind us. And so I suggested to him, and I was grateful that he agreed, first of all, to write a short book with myself under the modest title, How to Solve the Israel-Palestine Conflict. And then tonight, he was just speaking at the Harvard Kennedy School, and he graciously agreed to come over and do, as it were, a test run of what we're going to be proposing. And I have to say a lot of what he'll be saying tonight will also be of great interest to me, because I'm not sure exactly what he will be proposing. But I think we're on the same page. The he I'm referring to is Muin Rabbani, and without trying to flatter him and sticking strictly to the facts, I do think, and here I'm not being facetious, he's the shrewdest political analyst on the Israel-Palestine conflict in the world today. There's just nobody who even approaches him in knowledge, in perceptiveness. I'm not just saying that. That's why I wanted him to co-author the book. And I've said all along to my publisher, if he's not the co-author, I can't do it, because he knows what he's talking about, and he's also very sensible. I can't go through his whole history. I know he because I don't know it, actually. But what I do know is he did attend Tufts University. He then spent some time at Georgetown, if I'm not mistaken. He then worked, to his greatest credit, he was the first executive director of Al-Haq. Researcher at Al-Haq, which was the main Palestinian human rights organization, which was very active during the first Intifada, the years 1987 to 1993. And that was roughly the period I first got to know Moeen. In more recent times, he headed up the Palestine desk for the International Crisis Group, and now he's a fairly pervasive presence in the Arab media in particular, analyzing the Israel-Palestine conflict. For those of you who follow Al Jazeera Arabic, he's quite frequently on. And he's also writing. And he'll be the first speaker. Just the order of presentation this evening, Moeen will be setting out the general picture, not just as current events, but more importantly, why the current political situation allows for the possibility, if not the certainty, at any rate the possibility, for actually resolving the conflict. I will then try to suggest what should be the goal that we set for resolving the conflict. And then Moeen will address, within the context of the goal that we set, he will address the question of the refugees, and I will address the question of the settlements. And once that is done, it will be an opportunity for everybody here to also step in and have their say, whether in the form of a statement or questions. So having said that, here's Moeen.
Thank you, Norm. You did set the bar very low. Just one small correction. I haven't appeared on Al Jazeera Arabic. I don't do live interviews in Arabic because of insufficient mastery of the language. I've done some pre-recorded because those can always be edited and corrected. But anyway, what I'd like to discuss this evening is basically looking at where the region is today and where it might be heading, where the Palestinians are today and where they might be heading, and by way of conclusion, what that may, could, and hopefully can mean for the future of the Palestinian people and a potential resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian and broader Arab-Israeli conflict. I suppose the obvious place to start is by saying that the region is in a state of unprecedented transformation, a revolutionary moment that we haven't experienced since 1958, and that may well, in the months and years ahead, develop into an Arab 1848. Like 1848, it's not something that's going to bring immediate or immediately positive results, but sets in train the prospects of a transformation, of a fundamental transformation of the constitutional order, of the political order, of social and economic order in the region, with the possibility of a more bearable future for the peoples of the region and for their rights. Now, within this transformation, which I probably don't need to describe in too much detail for you, because I suspect many of you have been following it on your television screens and elsewhere, the extraordinary scenes of the popular uprising, first in Tunisia against an autocrat and dictator whom many of us expected to last in power for at least several lifetimes, and then in Egypt, ousting a dictator who was going to remain in power for a second lifetime through the agency of his son, and now, as we've seen elsewhere in the region, throughout the region really, from Morocco in the west to Oman in the east. Within this transformation, which is characterized, let's say, not by military coups and conspiracies within and among the elite, but has been fundamentally characterized by people's taking to the streets, breaking through the barrier of fear, and challenging their leaders and their intelligence agencies, and even in cases their armies, often with nothing more than bare hands that hold nothing more than banners with slogans. Within this context, we've also begun to see, I think, real changes in the Palestinian arena. To take a step back, the Palestine question since the early 1990s has been dominated by what's conventionally known as the peace process. This began in Madrid at the end of 1991, metamorphosed into the Oslo process and the Oslo framework in September of 1993. And if there's one way to characterize it, it would be that the previous framework of dealing with the Palestine question, which was one in which Palestinians sought to achieve the right of national self-determination on the basis of inalienable rights guaranteed to them by UN resolutions and international law, was transformed into a framework where the Palestinian people were basically transformed into a hamster running in the wheel and never catching the bait. It was one where Palestinians had to prove their worthiness, not even for rights, but even, you know, for basic interests like getting, for example, tax transfers that were already guaranteed to them according to various treaties that they had signed by Israel, which could be either given or withheld at will, almost by royal prerogative. But we had basically a different framework emerging, in which Palestinians were placed in the position that they had to consistently, ceaselessly demonstrate that they were eligible for crumbs from the table. These were crumbs that were thrown by the Israelis, but more importantly, there was the all-powerful American arbiter standing in the room who would determine when, where, and how the Israelis should be throwing yet another crumb to the Palestinians. So we had a period of 2 decades of what was conventionally known as the peace process, but which I think is more appropriately termed the consolidation of Israeli occupation on the basis of an ever-deepening process of Palestinian fragmentation. Fragmentation most notably geographically, in which the Palestinian authority areas were individually encircled and separated by areas of exclusive control. We had most notably the fragmentation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip, whereas until the early 1990s, one could get into a car in the northern West Bank and without too much difficulty drive to the southern Gaza Strip. That became simply impossible, and it became simply impossible in the context of the peace process. And then, of course, also the separation of the West Bank from East Jerusalem, leading to the gradual atrophy of East Jerusalem, because it's a city that is not viable except on the basis of its organic connection to the rest of the West Bank, and that's something that was severed. Now, what we saw in the past several years was not only continuing exponential expansion of Israeli settlements and so on, but growing doubts that a two-state settlement, which was the supposed objective of the Oslo framework, that it ever could be achieved. And the reason is that there were three preconditions for a successful outcome. First of all, you would need sufficient international and particularly American pressure on Israel to disgorge the occupied territories. Secondly, you would need an Israeli leadership that was capable of surviving a decision to withdraw from the occupied territories. And third of all, you would need an Israeli capability to actually implement such a decision without, for example, bringing on a military rebellion on its hands. Now, when people look at the rightward shift in Israeli society, the prospects of very widespread insubordination in the ranks of the Israeli military if an order to withdraw from the West Bank would be given and so on, people increasingly concluded that in the absence not only of American pressure, but even the prospect of American pressure on Israel, and the absence of an Israeli government that seemed capable of ever taking a decision to withdraw from the occupied territories, that the days of a two-state settlement were numbered. And I think one need only look at the map to realize why people were increasingly concluding either that a two-state settlement was past tense or that that moment was very rapidly approaching. Having said that, and having myself been one of those who was also coming to that conclusion in recent years, I have to say that the developments over the past year in the region, but also in the Palestinian arena, give real cause for reconsideration and give cause for renewed belief that a two-state settlement, a genuine two-state settlement, not, you know, the Bantustan plus scenario that had been proposed, that could be achieved. And here I think it makes sense to start also by looking at the initiative by the Palestinian leadership to go to the United Nations last September. Now, the background to this has to do with the assumption of office of the Obama administration in January 2009 and the belief among the Palestinian leadership that salvation was at most just around the corner. Obama, in his electoral campaign, had repeatedly spoken of the need to have a fundamentally different relationship with the Muslim world after the Bush years, and had indicated that he saw the need to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict as central to that changed relationship. He appointed a Mideast envoy, I think within 36 hours of taking office, rather than, and seemed to be different not only from Bush, but even from Clinton, who waited until the waning days of his second term to engage seriously with this conflict. And there were other signals that to the Palestinian, or to the Palestinian leadership, indicated that things were now going to be different, not realizing that the most that could be expected under an Obama administration was a revival of the Oslo process, a process that was all about process and not about peace, in which actually the things that have been seen and denounced as violations of Oslo were not violations of Oslo: consolidation of occupation, settlement expansion, and so on. Oslo was designed for these things, and there could not be another outcome. So if we fast forward a year, we see a situation in which Obama, having initially been seen as a almost a Jesus-like savior by elements of the Palestinian leadership, was increasingly seen as more of a Judas by increasing segments of Palestinian society. And dealing with the process as he proposed it was really one disappointment after another. At the same time, the Palestinians were also dealing with their abiding schism between the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, where you had one part of the Palestinian national movement, the Hamas movement, exercising hegemony over the Gaza Strip, and another, Fatah, exercising hegemony over the West Bank under overall Israeli control. And the leadership in the West Bank felt increasing pressure to do something, to seek an achievement in the context of these internal rivalries. The third element, of course, was the regional transformation that placed enormous pressure on the Palestinian leadership to break with business as usual, because not only their credibility, but their very legitimacy was being called into question. This also had to do with, for example, the collusion of this leadership during the Israeli assault on the Gaza Strip in at the end of 2008 and early 2009, the way that the leadership had undermined the Goldstone report at the Human Rights Commission, and so on. So out of this kind of cauldron of disappointment, frustration, popular pressures, and demands for action, came the idea of submitting, of going back to the United Nations. The first sign of this was in February of this year, when the Palestinian leadership went to the Security Council to seek a resolution condemning further Israeli settlement expansion. Amazingly, they didn't think that the U.S. would veto it. They genuinely believed that in the context of these of the regional upheaval, Washington would be very wary of vetoing such a resolution, particularly because the text of the resolution was basically a cut-and-paste job from official American statements. Nevertheless, the U.S. did veto the resolution, as might be expected, and this was, I think, for many seen as kind of a death blow to the prospects of a revival of meaningful negotiations with a meaningful agenda. And we then, over the summer, saw a growing move to go towards the United Nations to seek full Palestinian membership in the UN. Now, I think it's important to point out that, unfortunately, this was not done as part of any coherent strategy. There were no real preparations. So, for example, at the end of the day, the Palestinian leadership decided to go to the Security Council rather than the General Assembly. But what we saw is that efforts to lobby the individual Security Council members began not 6 months before submitting the application, but several days or weeks after. And this has to do with kind of the haphazard pattern of policymaking of that section of the Palestinian leadership that undertook this initiative. Nevertheless, I think the key issue here is, or there are two issues here. The first is that, seen from the perspective of those who sponsored the initiative at the UN, internationalizing the question of Palestine and moving away, decisively away, from the Oslo process was never on their agenda. Rather, they were seeking to give the Oslo framework what you might call electric shock therapy, hoping that this would serve as a wake-up call to the Obama administration, in exchange for which the Americans would either, that they would offer something in return. You know, it's kind of one of these hold me back before I kill him kind of things. And it simply didn't work. The Americans turned around and kicked the Palestinians in the teeth. They said they would veto it. They said that the Palestinians would get nothing in return. And if you look at the statement that the quartet gave after the Palestinian application was submitted to the Security Council, it proposed a new framework for negotiations that was actually significantly worse than what the quartet had proposed in previous instances, and that's quite an achievement. Nevertheless, I think the more important point is that the move towards the UN has set in motion agendas and processes which have developed beyond the control of those sponsoring that initiative. I think simply by having gone to the UN, the leadership has made it impossible to now return to the negotiating table in the absence of a clear and credible agenda for ending the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip and East Jerusalem. They simply cannot go back to the negotiating table and survive. It would be political suicide for them. Secondly, I think it is, however inadvertently, the beginning of the renewed internationalization of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. In other words, it's the beginning of a new process whereby the framework for addressing and resolving this conflict is UN resolutions and international law, rather than basically American officials determining what Palestinians can and can't have based on the process of Israeli needs and interests to the total exclusion of Palestinian rights. This is not going to happen overnight, but I think this move by the Palestinians represents the beginnings of a decisive break with the Oslo process, which can only be for the good. I think it's also the beginnings of the end of the quartet. Now, for those of you who were unfamiliar with the quartet was established by the Bush administration in 2002, basically as a substitute for the international community, as a substitute for the United Nations, more or less. And for the past 8-9 years, the quartet has presented itself as representing the will of the international community. Yet, if we see what has actually happened at the UN in the past few months, it's become clear to everyone that the positions of the quartet and that of the planet are actually diametrically opposed, and that they don't complement each other in the least. And thus far, at least, the Palestinians have refused to significantly re-engage with the quartet on Tony Blair's terms. By way of conclusion, I'd just like to say a few words about what might be next. I think, at least for Palestinians, the absolute precondition for being able to get any advantage out of the current situation, whether these changes in Palestinian strategy, which I've been discussing, or the regional transformation, the absolute precondition is Palestinian national reconciliation. Basically a revived Palestinian national movement on the basis of a partnership between the key Palestinian organizations, primarily, of course, Fatah and Hamas, but also others, including not only political movements, but also core constituencies that have, over the course of the past two decades, been completely marginalized in the context of the Oslo process. I'm here thinking primarily of the Palestinian diaspora, but also the Palestinian community within
the green line. Now, this has to be done on the basis of a common political program. And the common political program that has been all but agreed between these various factions is a two-state settlement based on relevant UN resolutions and international law. Next, the Palestinians will need to develop a coherent strategy. As we've seen in the past few months, you can't simply go to the UN and throw in an application and expect any results from it within a matter of days or weeks or even months. It has to be embedded in a coherent strategy which involves preparation, discipline, commitment, but also, and perhaps most importantly, mobilization. The Palestinian people, not only the Palestinian people need to be mobilized, but especially now that in a sense, the will of the Arab people is being unleashed by these regional transformations, Arab solidarity needs to be mobilized. And last but by no means least, international solidarity needs to be mobilized. We've seen, if you look at Europe, for example, there's been a fundamental transformation over the course of the past two decades. We previously used to have a situation in Europe where governments were, to one extent or another, rather neutral on this issue, but European public opinion tended to be strongly pro-Israeli. Well, the situation now is opposite. I mean, for many sectors of European public opinion, Israel has become more or less a dirty word. Yet, what we've seen during the same period is that European governments have become increasingly pro-Israeli. But there's a lot of work to do here in the sense that there's a lot of activism by Palestinians and solidarity activists on this issue. And it has achieved results, but one need only think of how much greater the results of such activism would be if it was actually sponsored and supported by a genuinely representative national leadership. I mean, you know, one could think of how much longer the South Africans would have had to struggle if, for example, the divestment campaign was not actively supported by the ANC during the 1980s. So, just to sum up, my last point, the region now is at a critical historical juncture. I think the most important impact of this transformation is that it has, for the first time in decades, renewed possibility. It's very difficult to tell where things are going to end up, but I think it's equally true that it's not foreordained, that human agency plays a key role here, and how people seek to influence these changes and play a role in these changes will, I think, be fundamental to where these changes will end up. Thank you.
That was Mouin Rabbani's main presentation at the BU conference, and we now want to continue it with his follow-up on the right of return.
Thank you. I don't pretend to bring any moral authority to bear on this question, and I also have never been, just to get this out of the way, I've never been particularly enthusiastic about identity politics. I'd like to make a few remarks about the refugee question and the two-state settlement, just based on my own interest and involvement in the matter. I think it's important to first take a step back and recall the origins of the Palestinian refugee question. On November 29th, 1947, the United Nations General Assembly which was in a very different General Assembly and did not yet include Palau or Micronesia, or I think over 100 of the other states that would subsequently join it, adopted a resolution recommending the partition of Palestine into two states, a Jewish state and an Arab state. This resolution, as you know, was immediately and emphatically rejected not only by the Arab population of Palestine, but indeed by the entire Arab world, for what were and remain, I think, entirely justifiable reasons, which is that the General Assembly presumed to give sovereignty over 50% of Palestine to the Jewish immigrant population, which had in its vast majority settled there during the previous decades under basically British rule, and controlled only 7% of the land of Mandatory Palestine, and formed more or less only 50% of the population of that portion of Palestine which was allotted by the General Assembly to a Jewish state. I think it's also important to note that when the General Assembly recommended the establishment of a Jewish state in part of Mandatory Palestine, it never intended to in any way authorize the ethnic cleansing of that portion of Palestine. Yet what we saw was the immediate beginning of conflict, first a civil conflict within Mandatory Palestine until the 15th of May 1948 between the two communities, and then after the State of Israel was proclaimed on the 15th of May, an interstate conflict between the newly established state and the surrounding ones. During that conflict, 90% of the Arab population of those parts of Palestine, which became the State of Israel, were essentially ethnically cleansed from their territory, from their homes, from their villages, and so on. 90% of, not the 50% of Palestine that was allotted to the Jewish state, but rather the 78% of Palestine that became Israel. And I think the key issue to understand about the refugee question is it's not so much a question of whether people fled as a precaution, were expelled, or fled in terror. The key issue here is that at the conclusion of the war, none of these refugees, in many cases people not yet realizing that they were refugees, were permitted to return to their homes. And already in December of 1948, the General Assembly adopted a further resolution, 194, according to which Palestinians were provided the right of return. The exact wording of the resolution is something along the lines of all Palestine refugees wishing to return to their homes and live at peace with their neighbors should be allowed to do so and should be compensated also for damages and loss of property and so on. That was in 1948. What we've had over subsequent decades is now a situation where the majority of Palestinians today, including the majority of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip and something between 30% and 40% of Palestinians in the West Bank, and including a very sizable proportion of Palestinians who are Israeli citizens, are in fact dispossessed, uprooted refugees. Now, how does one go about addressing this issue, and more importantly, how does one go about addressing this issue in the context of a two-state settlement? Well, there is a view that there is, at some level, a fundamental contradiction between the right of return and a two-state settlement. My view is that the key to unlocking the supposed contradiction, and that the key to the resolution of the Palestinian refugee question, lies in an explicit and unambiguous recognition of the right of return of dispossessed and uprooted Palestinian refugees and descendants. In other words, I feel that it's my view that if this right is not recognized, this issue can and will never be resolved. And I'd also like to point out that when we speak of a two-state solution on the 67 borders, it's often forgotten that the core of this conflict, and in my view, the most vexing issue, if you will, one that is more emotive and more existential than the issue of settlements, than the issue even of Jerusalem, is the issue of is the Palestinian refugee question. And we've had a variety of formulas over the years. For example, the Geneva Accords this was an informal peace negotiation held between a variety of Israelis and Palestinians about 10 years ago, and came up with this formula, and the conclusion of which was that, you know, Palestinians will not have the right of return, and I can't remember the exact wording, and Israel will not recognize it, but this will be seen as the implementation of 194. It's something akin to an agreement in 1995 reached between Mahmoud Abbas, the current Palestinian president, and a liberal Israeli politician, Yossi Beilin, where they resolved the question of Jerusalem by basically saying that the future Palestinian state would be given sovereignty over a village on the outskirts of Jerusalem named Abu Dis, but that it would be renamed Al-Quds, which is the Arabic name for Jerusalem, and that thereby the Palestinian capital would be in Jerusalem, and that would resolve the question of Jerusalem. Well, I think the key issue to understand is that you can't resolve the Palestinian refugee question with smoke and mirrors. The core of any resolution has to be an explicit Israeli recognition of the right of return and of its direct responsibility for causing and perpetuating the Palestinian refugee question. Once that's been done, then I think a negotiated resolution of this question becomes possible, including one that the vast majority of Palestinians, including Palestinian refugees, would be prepared to accept as a just resolution of the refugee question. Absent an explicit Israeli recognition of responsibility and of Palestinian rights, I simply don't see how that could be achieved. Now, if we get into specifics of what will this look like on the ground, I think it's easier to determine what won't work than to determine what will work. For example, there was a proposal at some point during the brief period in which Israelis and Palestinians sought to negotiate the so-called permanent status issues, in which it was said that the right of return would be subject to Israeli sovereign discretion, and that only Palestinians who physically resided in their home villages prior to 1948, presumably without their direct descendants and families, would be allowed with very restricted criteria and so on. That's not going to work. Perhaps a formula in which all Palestinians still alive who resided within what is now Israel, including any of their descendants who would like to return, that might possibly be something that many, perhaps most Palestinians would be prepared to accept. There's another issue here, which is the question of compensation. And here I would like to just make one brief point, which is that I do not think that refugee rights can be purchased with financial compensation, particularly if any fund that is established to compensate Palestinian refugees is an international fund led by the U.S. Or the EU or the World Bank or whatever. I think the party that is directly responsible for Palestinian dispossession and for having perpetuated the Palestinian refugee question over the past 60 years has to be a leading and direct participant in any compensation scheme. Now, if Israel were to get money from the Americans or Europeans or whatever, that's a different question. But the idea that somehow a Palestinian refugee would be compensated by Denmark rather than by Israel is something that, in my view, simply won't fly. So, unfortunately, I do not have very clear ideas or very specific ideas on what a resolution would look like. I do have very clear ideas on what a resolution will not look like, about what won't work. It does, however, remain my conviction that a explicit recognition of the right of Palestinian refugees and explicit recognition of Israeli responsibility will make a negotiated resolution, in other words, a resolution that is acceptable to both parties and, most importantly, acceptable to the vast majority of Palestinians, including Palestinian refugees, that will then become possible. Thank you.
You have been listening to Middle East scholar and author Muin Rabbani speaking at Boston University. طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Jimmy Savile, Hillsborough, Orgreave, David Kelly, Chilcot and nobody prosecuted. Whatever happened to British justice? Next week, the secret rulers of the Western world get together with the apex of the German government, all there to plan how to keep Britain out of the EU. We look behind the mainstream media wizard of Oz curtain to find how our futures are decided behind closed doors by groups such as NATO and the Bilderbergers, who have some very real and disturbing connections to the Nazis. Also, as I said, Jimmy Savile, Hillsborough, Orgreave, the Birmingham Six, all these varying degrees, proven perjury by police and other officials who never face prosecution by the police or the Crown Prosecution Service. Now, Deep Cut Barracks 2. We take a close look tonight at what was going on at Deep Cut, why Nicholas Blake QC's multi-million pound official inquiry came to the ridiculous conclusion that four soldiers actually committed suicide. And look at the four trainee soldiers almost certainly murdered at Deep Cut and ask, is the British legal system fit for purpose? An answer, no. Plus Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots, our sister show Dialects, back at noon every Tuesday. More from Ian Fleming novel Decoder, U.S. Marine Corps veteran, combat reformer Mike Sparks this week, as he gives us the background to the rise of fascism in the United States, right the way back to the 1934 coup attempt against President Roosevelt, organised by George W. Bush's grandfather, Prescott Bush. That's at noon next Tuesday. But first, I'm joined on the line, I hope anyway, by Andy Thomas. Hi, Andy. Welcome to the Politics Show. I think we better just plunge straight into the next story we're going to have a look at, which is to do with the Israelis, actually. Martin, there's been a big... It's been massive news in Israel, but it's been almost virtually not here in Britain whatsoever. What we've seen is a knife being kicked towards a Palestinian assailant after an Israeli soldier shot him this week. A video introduced the manslaughter trial of the Israeli soldier for the shooting dead of a wounded Palestinian assailant has shown a knife being kicked towards the assailant's body after the fact. So there was a guy basically lying down. They were saying he was a knife attacker, lying down on the ground. And yet the soldier shoots him, it seems, in the head and then kicks a knife towards his body. In other words, trying to frame him.
A lot of violence going on towards Palestinian communities, but it's been overshadowed for us by Brexit, of course, and also, of course, by the war in Syria, which has been pretty gruesome. But, of course, the situation for Palestinians has remained very bad. The human rights abuses against them have increased. And, of course, there's been an awful lot of killings, which are supposedly crazed knife attackers who just turned out to be random people who've been executed out of hand by the Israeli Defence Forces.
Well, this report is from the Jewish Telegraph Agency, and it's absolutely appalling. It does look as if you've got squads of Israeli soldiers who have been somehow coached in how to, you know, basically fit somebody up. So shooting somebody in the head and then kicking a knife over towards their body is a pretty horrific thing to do. You're then just going to say, oh, look, there was a knife on the body, and and accuse them of being there to attack you, when actually what you've done is you've shot an innocent civilian in the head.
Well, there's also evidence that settlers have been attacking Palestinian homes with firebombs, etc., and then when Palestinians retaliate, then they face the full might of the Israeli Defence Forces. It's all happening. I mean, obviously, in Israel itself, this stuff is top of the agenda. But I'm afraid, with our own obsessions, we're losing track of it. But, of course, the Israeli Defence Forces are also sticking their fingers in Syria, as are our own Defence Forces, which is probably closer to home from our point
of view.
Israeli
Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Defence Minister Moshe Yalon immediately condemned the killing at the time, but then they, I don't know about Yalon, but Netanyahu, first thing he did was call the soldier's father, and what many saw as a sign of support for him.
Yes, well, I mean, basically, you know, when you see somebody shot in the head who's clearly, basically disarmed, if nothing else, there's a clear breach of law, of international law there. But I'm afraid within Israel itself, a very nasty right-wing mood has developed where the lives of Palestinians simply are not regarded as the same as other human lives.
This is the problem, isn't it? At the time, this did go all the way around the world, this attack, many times around the world as a news story, even though now there's no real reporting of this trial here in the UK. But it went around the world as a knife attack by a Palestinian who the soldiers had to shoot dead.
Well, indeed. And of course, the former Israeli generals have spoken out, actually, saying that what's going on in Israel is comparable to what went on in Nazi Germany in the 30s. These are retired Israeli Defence Force generals who are saying
that. I noticed there's a filmmaker as well that was saying exactly the same. So, yeah, pretty horrific stuff there. But also, something else I would sort of draw quite close to this is the reports during the week that one of the senior Israeli army officers actually went to one of the places which was supposed to be completely in control of al-Nusra and ISIS. And this sort of thing, is there any real relationship between
there
the
is.
Israeli military?
There and is. There's evidence that al-Nusra and ISIS fighters have been taken into Israel for medical treatment and then put back into the fight inside Syria. And in fact, Druze militants in the Golan Heights attacked the ambulances which were carrying these ISIS fighters into Israel, and there was an incident surrounding that. But of course, it's open knowledge in the Middle East by those who know that ISIS and al-Nusra Front are being armed, trained and directed by the Israelis, the British, the Americans, the Saudis and the Qataris. That is, you know, everybody knows that's what's going on. But meanwhile, we're being taught we have to go to war to stop ISIS. Meanwhile, of course, our chaps have been training and arming them. Some mistake, surely.
Well, let's try and regain a connection with Andy Thomas now. Hi, Andy. Can you hear me?
Yeah, hi.
Oh, hurrah. You're there on the phone.
Yeah, the good old telephone.
Good old-fashioned way of doing things. Anyway, just to introduce Andy, he is the author of two books that I know of. One is Conspiracies, the Facts, the Theories and the Evidence. The other one is The Truth Agenda, Making Sense of Unexplained Mysteries, Global Cover-Ups, which is the bit which I've underlined, and Visions for a New Era in 2013. Do you want to just tell us a little bit about what inspired you to write those, Andy?
Sure. I mean, the thing is, there's so much of this stuff floating around, as you know, which gets branded under the header conspiracy theory. And if you're slightly on the outside of it, it can seem overwhelming. People don't know where to start. They don't quite know how it all pulls together. So what I tried to do in both those books, where Truth Agenda includes a bit more unexplained mystery stuff, as you suggest, whereas Conspiracies is pretty more hardcore real-world stuff for the most part. But it's trying to say, look, what are the binding threads? What's the overall hypothesis here of people that are very concerned about the way the world is going and what we're not being told? So both those books, they try to give you, in as much of a nutshell as you can, the overall impression of what's going on and give you hopefully enough information that you can then go out there and start to explore the avenues that, you know, speak to you more than anything and try and do something about it. Because ultimately, if we want to turn all of this kind of stuff around, everybody needs to stand up to the plate and do something, even if it's just one small thing, from saving your local bus shelter to campaigning for anti-corruption on your local council. You know, if everybody did something to try to get to the truth and just stop this, you know, insane world that we're in, which is so obviously manipulated and engineered, we'd all get somewhere. And that's what the books are trying to do, and that's what I try to do in the lectures I give as well, is give people enough to get them started on a road so that we can actually get some serious reform going.
Well, in the media, of course, there's a massive amount of motivation, financial, for disinformation. Why is that?
Well, I mean, you know, the bottom line is always the state, the establishment, it protects itself first and foremost. And I think that's what we're always up against. And in the end, it becomes self-reflexive, because what they're doing is they start off by wanting power. Then when you've got some level of power, of course, you've got to cling on to it. And the only way they can cling on to it is to continually keep the public basically stupid in the dark. And that agenda is obvious. I mean, if you walk around W.H. Smith on any average day and you just look at the magazines that are there, the complete distraction, the mind rot that people have fed, of course, keeps them busy. So then most people don't get drawn to the really important stuff. They're not encouraged to do anything about it, and they don't even know what's going on.
I think it's fair to say, isn't it, that nowadays the stuff that's presented in front of our faces, that is to say even places like Waterstones, the books which are laid out for you as you walk in there, most of that is drivel, nonsense and distraction of various sorts, that now there's an onus on people, mainly, I suppose, using the internet, to actually go out and find things out for themselves. But not everyone has got the time to do that, Andy.
No, and that's why, I mean, it's important that the people that can see what's going on can, as much as possible, give a very clear and as quick a picture as possible to show other people why you need to look beyond that. And you can, and those conduits are there. And as you say, the internet has been an absolute gift, which is, of course, why the establishment would love to control it and shut it down, and they're trying to do that through various nefarious means. But at the moment, the alternative media is alive and strong. More and more people have been drawn to that because they know the BBC, they know the Waterstones or whatever, they're not giving them the whole picture. And we're now seeing that more and more. And even Amazon has started stocking, or rather stopped stocking, certain titles that now they don't approve of. So censorship is starting to creep in on a number of levels, which is very worrying, because you only look at Amazon to see what books there are, if they're not there, you may never know they exist.
Well, I would recommend if anyone's going online to try and get hold of a book, go on to bookfinder.com. There are others as well, but, you know, that uses Amazon as one of its places to get hold of a book. But look, one of the things I wanted to do, if possible with you, Andy, is rather than drill into the detail of this upcoming EU referendum, is to look at some of the sort of much bigger, wider stuff that you and other people have dug out over the years about what's going on with the EU. Because I don't think there's much doubt in my mind that this is a big potential turning point in history, you know, whether we're going to be part of this United States of Europe or not is going to be fascinating to see, and it will have an impact in the future. I mean, even Jeremy Corbyn, various other people have acknowledged this is, particularly for young people, is going to make a massive difference as to the world that they spend most of their lives in the future. And I noticed that you made reference to a book by Toyn Newton called The Occult Origins of the European Union, which sounds to me as if it might be a bit iffy, but it's saying that there is something else going on behind the scenes. The word occult really just means hidden, but it's essentially what you're getting at there. I mean, I remember reading years ago a book by Dionne Fortune, can't remember the title of it, but she was explaining, say, well, mysticism is this kind of airy-fairy stuff that you kind of, you may get in your head, you may get visions or whatever, but the occult is the stuff that is going on behind the scenes which has been completely hidden. That's essentially all it is. So what do you think about the origins of the European Union, occult or otherwise?
Well, I mean, they go back quite a long way. There's another researcher I'd really recommend, a guy called Terry Boardman, and he's got a great website called threeman.org, and he's been giving a lot of talks for a long time about the origins of Europe, the First World War, the Second World War, and he knows his history. And when you look back, you can begin to see certain things falling into place that begin to create a series of superstates. So we all talk about the New World Order, but that is a real project. But it has various conduits which have fed into creating what we now today call the EU. You've got the Pilgrim Society, you've got the Round Table, you've got a lot of sort of machinations early in the 20th century which begin to put people into power who are clearly playing a long game. And one unsung aspect to the whole EU thing, which Terry brings out, and I know you yourself have, is the fact that Europe was very much encouraged into being to suit the Americans. And of course we're now seeing that with the whole TTIP trade deal they're trying to push through, which will make Europe far more malleable to corporate American interests and pretty much ends all idea of sovereignty then and there. So the EU is not what people want it to be. And one interesting thing, a lot of younger people who've been brought up with the EU and, you know, they've had Common Purpose and groups like this in the background making the EU seem like a good thing to them, they want to stick to it because it's what they know. And in the idealized view of things, they think it's a great collective, it's a good way forward, which in theory it should be, but what they don't see is the way it was set up. It was set up to suit corporate interests. Yes, there is clearly secret society influence in it. And to be fair, Toyn Newton's book is actually very well researched. If you just look at the origins of the signs and symbolisms that were used, you know, from the very start, the whole EU project, it tells you what you're dealing with.
Yeah, I'll just stop you there for a second, because one of the things I would say to anyone that's got a euro in their pocket, well, you're doing well if you've got any money at all these days. So many of us are in debt, you know, but if you've got a euro in your pocket, turn it over and have a look on the back. What you've got there is a picture of Europe on the right-hand side and a bridge leading off across the Atlantic. So I don't know what that means in terms of symbolism. It seems pretty obvious, Andy.
Well, I think it is. I mean, you mentioned in your introduction the Bilderberg Group. So this is this slightly shadowy organisation. I mean, it's all admitted and it accepts that it's there, and yet you don't hear much about it. But that was set up in 1954, and I'll give you a direct quote. Quote, designed to foster dialogue between Europe and North America. Now, that's what it says it's there to do. The problem we've got is it's clearly got a lot more clout than they let on. They say it's just a think tank. Well, it's clearly much, much more than that. I mean, in 2010, the former NATO Secretary General, Willy Claeys, he actually admitted that Bilderberg does set the global policy basically for the year ahead. What gets discussed there is laying down what's going to happen that year. And in 2009, the then Bilderberg chairman, Etienne Davignon, actually claimed that the euro, the currency, was actually a Bilderberg idea. So if you then look back into these kinds of people who are part of this and the people that attend the Bilderberg meetings, you begin to see, hang on a minute, maybe the EU wasn't set up for our benefit, which is what's being sold to us at the moment. And we've been frightened to say, well, if you leave, you'll have no money, your holidays will cost more, and all of this. It was never set up to serve our needs, the everyday folk, and never will be. It was basically for the people at the top to protect their interests, to protect American interests. And there's a lot more beneath this than is meeting the eye. And the fact that the Bilderberg meetings are hardly known about by most people is, of course, one of the shocking things.
Because, well, it's not so shocking when you consider that quite a lot of the mainstream media are there as well, big organisations like the BBC, that we're also talking about News International, that seems to be a major part of it, as well as people like The Economist. But when the thing is, when these journalists go there, they are swearing, you know, basically an oath of secrecy that we won't report on this, we will only use it for our own possibly personal benefit and as part of the running of our organisation. And another thing that often gets forgotten is that these media companies increasingly are massive multinational corporations themselves, and so of course they are going to actually be much more interested in a United States of Europe which is run by big corporations for big corporations than they are in sort of delivering that fact to the listeners and viewers. But look, you said something a minute ago, Andy, about the US and their involvement in it at the start of the Bilderberg and the European Union, and I caught a clip of Paul Craig Roberts. Now, he's a former US Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for Economic Policy under President Reagan back in the 1980s. And he was talking to Julian Charles on the Mind Renewed podcast recently about this very subject.
The EU is a creation of the CIA. And this was discovered some years ago by an American professor who happened upon released documents in the archive of the United States, where public documents are put when they are released from their, you know, their time holding.
Was it Georgetown University? I think I read some.
Georgetown or George Washington, I think it was. But you see, it was reported on by the Telegraph, by Ambrose Evans Pritchard, in the year 2000. And I think I mentioned that in my column, that this was 16 years ago, reported in the Telegraph by Ambrose, who was for a while, I guess, the Telegraph's correspondent in Washington. And the documents show that the CIA did this, basically organized, orchestrated, lobbied for the creation of the EU for two reasons. One, as a bloc against the Soviets, and two, as enabling Washington's control, because to control all the separate European governments is much more time-consuming, demanding, involved than controlling an EU government, especially something with an EU commission that's not accountable. And so Washington set it up in order to have a firm hold on its European empire.
And this goes back to, according to Ambrose Evans Pritchard, this goes back to the 1950s and 60s, I understand.
Yes, back to the 50s, I think it was. I don't have my article in front of me, but it was a creation of the CIA as a way of enhancing Washington's empire. You know, for Washington to have to go to Italy, to France, to Germany, to the British, negotiate with each of these governments. There are more people you have to bribe or threaten or cajole, and then the countries themselves can increase their demands for what they want in return, because if one holds out, no deal can be made. Whereas if Europe is dissolved, if the European countries are dissolved into one entity, then Washington only has to deal with one entity. And so this was the origin of the EU for that purpose. It facilitates Washington's control, and that is why Washington has pushed so strongly to put all of Eastern Europe into both the EU and NATO, because otherwise, how many countries are there, European? I can't remember, the Eastern, the Western, the 28 or 29.
That's the voice of Paul Craig Roberts there, the former U.S. presidential advisor to Ronald Reagan back in the 1980s and in the U.S. cabinet as well, talking about the origins of the EU. Andy, what he's essentially saying there is that if you're going to control 500 million people in Europe, it's much easier to have one organization to deal with.
Yeah, absolutely, and I think that's long been their aim. And another thing that got mentioned there that I think is something that's not understood is Russia, because, I mean, throughout history, Russia's always been kept out of anything to do with any Western negotiations, and America is absolutely, you know, paralyzed with fear that, say, Germany and Russia could become allies.
Well, hang on, because Russia was brought into the G8, wasn't it, for a while?
For a while, but now, if you look at what's going on today, the demonization, of course, that's going towards Russia, it's virtually setting up, you know, yet another Cold War, in so many words. And I think the EU, it would suit them, of course, absolutely, to be a tool towards doing that. And it is an unfortunate thing that, you know, it's almost as if they want us kept in conflict. I think that is another aim going on here in the EU. And by the way, anybody that seems to think the EU will reform tomorrow and it'll all be marvellous and we'll all be free within it has just clearly never looked at the treaties that have set this whole thing up. It's absolutely clear from the start that it was set up purely to become federal. There was never, ever meant to be any individual sovereignty left. So when David Cameron says, well, we have a special status within this, well, we don't. That will last hardly any time at all. And once we're very firmly within Europe, especially when what they call qualified majority voting comes in, which I think will be next year, that's going to change the whole way decisions are made in Europe, and it will give a lot more power to the other countries. It's meant to be more democratic, but actually what it does is create a collective where nobody can really swing it their way anymore. And we will have very little voice. And once we're in there, once we're part of that, there is no special status that can remain. And it was never intended to. And, you know, when Osborne and Cameron say, oh, no, it's going to be fine, they've clearly never read the treaties themselves, or they have. And, of course, they just don't want anybody to know what they really say. The plan for Europe is clear from the very beginning. That, I think, is a shame that most people are not being made aware of that in all the current arguments about whether you'll have more money or not. They don't seem to talk about the freedom aspect very much.
Well, let's just have a look at some of the more obvious things that have come out over the last few, couple of weeks, some articles that I've been collating, all of them alleging, and with some pretty strong evidence as well, that there's been a deliberate attempt over the last couple of months to hold back plans in order to wait until after the UK Brexit referendum by the European Union. There's this whole business of the possible accession of Turkey, which is probably a way off, but there are other countries in the former Yugoslavia, Serbia, Albania, Bosnia, Herzegovina, Montenegro, Kosovo, and Macedonia. Those talks have been put on hold. Then there's the formation of an EU army. Plans which have only been shown to EU diplomats are understood to include proposals for a new European military structure, including headquarters. This was in the Independent on the 27th, actually just a week ago, by Charlie Cooper. And also around about the same time, an article saying that the EU army has actually existed for a long time as part of something called the Political and Security Committee of the EU, which, I mean, this is the first I'd ever heard of it. And they have created something which is called the EU Battle Group, which has been doing manoeuvres on Salisbury Plain and various other places quietly. Some of these decisions about the EU army, it seems, are being held back until after the referendum, including the negotiations this week with the 10.3 billion euro loan to Athens. Now, a lot of people over in Greece were expecting another horrific bit of arm wrenching to take away their public services, to take away the infrastructure in order to get get this $10.3 billion loan this week, but they were gobsmacked to hear, Andy, that the bank has just said, mostly, of course, German bankers said, oh, it's okay, you can just have your $10.3 billion, no problem, until the next round.
Yeah, but that's always the way it works, of course. And, of course, this is how countries get reeled in and they get controlled. And, I mean, Greece, you know, everybody can see how they've been controlled just over the last two or three years to get them through their crises. And what the people want is irrelevant because, you know, they are compelled to have to do the biddings of the EU masters, ultimately. So we've got a choice here. We actually have an opportunity to step out of all of this. And I think this is where you need to think bigger. You know, the really poor level of debate that we're seeing in the mainstream, both sides, it's distraction really from what the key issues are. And yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right, there are things coming up that it's almost like they've been held back this long just to get us in. And some might argue, because we keep hearing, well, if we stay in the EU we'll be all better off. Some might argue, actually, the EU, I mean, it's been very unstable financially. The euro's been unstable. What's been propping that up all this time? Because that is an issue which has never really been explored. And if many other countries do join and then some crisis ripples through, of course, if we're part of that, we're more likely to be pulled down with it.
Now, Martin Summers is a Remainer, but let's bring him in on this, Martin, because I've just been pulling up some facts to do with the single market and the financial relationship, Andy. Maybe you could chip in a minute, but I'm going to fire this question off at Martin. This is just looking at some of the facts to do with the single market and how successful it's been. The European Union's been a shrinking market, apparently, for 10 years, hence they want more countries. This is one of the motivators to bring new countries in, as well as what we were hearing earlier from Andy. Britain is the second largest economy in the EU. We're the fifth largest economy in the world, and the EU is an internal market only. The EU only accounts for 40% of UK trade, and that amount is actually shrinking at the moment. And the rest of the world accounts for 60% of Britain's trade, and that amount is growing. So, you know, we shouldn't be too obsessed, whatever you think, about you know, making sure we can make sure that the EU trade works, because actually it's shrinking, that market, and the outside world is growing. So GDP per person from 1955 to 1975 grew 164%. From 75 to 95, it only grew 155%. And from 95 to 2013, it grew 133%. So the actual amount of growth per person in Britain has been going down and down and down. And so it does suggest, Martin, doesn't it, that a membership of the EU may be holding us back if our potential markets in the future are outside the union.
Well, I don't know where you've got these figures from, Tony. There's no actual byline for it, but let's just presume for a minute that there's some accuracy in what you're saying. The reason why GDP in Britain has slumped since 1975, I'll give you one simple word for that, Margaret Thatcher. The EU has virtually nothing to do with industrial policy in Britain in that period. Now, the EU is a cat's paw for NATO, but I don't hear many people saying, when are we leaving NATO? Perhaps we should be leaving NATO. The Greeks are very definitely discussing leaving NATO. Cyprus doesn't really want to be in NATO at all, but we've got bases there.
There hasn't been a referendum about that, has there?
No, there hasn't. And let's get real about what real... The EU is a glorified... it's a glorified talking shop controlled by the United States of America. That's the reality. That's the reality. And it's the United States of America and Britain who went to war in Iraq. France and Germany didn't want to know. Now, ultimately, of course, the real world out there is the Russians and all the rest of it. The war in the Ukraine has been created entirely by NATO, by NATO special forces and intelligence services, using the EU as a condom. Now, if you remember the famous telephone call between Catherine Ashton, who was the head of the EU's foreign policy section, and Urmas Piets, who was the Estonian foreign minister, where he briefed her and he said, well, it looks quite clear from talking around the hospitals that the shooting down of the pro-EU demonstrators was and police was carried out by Pravi Sector, who are a right-wing faction in the new government in the EU. And all of this has been orchestrated, not by the EU.
Martin, I'm just fading you out there, because it's not a right-wing faction, it's a far-right neo-Nazi faction.
Indeed. All right, well, but let's just point that Catherine Ashton, when it's pointed out to her, and of course, the Russians must have bugged the phone call, and of course, Umas Pirts has said yes, it definitely took place, this phone call. When he says, well, it looks like the demonstrators have been shot down by Pravi sector working probably with the new government, not the old government, which means, of course, MI6, CIA, and she goes, gosh, golly, really? And that just tells you what the EU is about. The EU is a hopeless bunch of spineless twerps who can't deal with the United States of America. And that's the fundamental problem. Nobody's talking about the... And, of course, who is the big cat's paw for the United States of America? Oh, that would be right-wing Tory governments in Britain. And right-wing Tory governments in Britain will go to Bilderberg, and on behalf of the Americans, they will tell the Germans that they're going to war with Russia, even though they don't want to go. But they're going to be told by Britain and America that they must go. If they had a stronger EU, they might be in a position to tell them to get lost, but they're not.
This might not be the best... Bilderberg next week to do that, might it?
No, it might very well be the case that the Germans, four former German chancellors, three social democrats and one Christian democrat, are saying that the policy on Russia is wrong. Because, of course, what's actually happening, we've got sanctions on Russia, which is the eighth biggest economy in the world. We are attempting to bankrupt Russia as we speak. Whether you should do that in the middle of a global economic crisis is another question. But who's pushing that? It's not being pushed by the more moderate members of the EU. It's being pushed by Britain within the EU and by the United States of America. Yeah. Now, how are we going to deal with the power of the United States of the America? That's a very big question. Maybe we should break up the EU and have a catastrophic breakup of the euro. That'll strengthen us to deal with the United States, won't it? Now, what's actually going to happen, in or out of Brexit, we're going to have a banking crash. And actually, we'll suddenly realise that we've been discussing rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. I'm fed up of talking about the EU. I'm fed up of talking about Brexit. In or out, the banks are bust, and somebody's trying to set up a war with Russia. How are we going to stop that? Maybe General de Gaulle will have something to say about it, but he's dead.
Well, Andy, I wonder if you'd like to just respond to what Martin's saying there, because he seems to be saying that actually, potentially anyway, a lot of European countries are looking at Britain and saying, well, we're a big problem, and maybe they may put the thumbs up to Britain leaving because they see us as a cat's paw for the US.
Yeah, I mean, just to respond to one thing Martin said there, in theory, the idea of a good, strong Europe to stand up against some of the things he's referring to there, yeah, would make sense. The problem is, that isn't the Europe we've got at the moment. I mean, if I thought that what we had was some kind of utopia run by sort of angelic realms, yeah, I'd be absolutely all for it, but... unfortunately, that is not the way it is. I think Martin is right. I think clearly there's going to be another crash. I mean, the economy has been somehow kept alive in Europe all this time. And I also do think there are problems. If we do leave the EU, I don't think that's panacea to all our problems. I think a right-wing Tory government could be a big problem here. And you could argue we might be more at their mercy outside of the EU. But ultimately, the EU is not a democratic organisation. We at least... theoretically have the ability to get rid of a government here if they're not behaving correctly. In the EU, we don't have that power. And it's going backwards. You know, we're going back into a system whereby basically you've got these faceless people at the top that you can't shift off. It's almost like going back into a feudal system. And I think that's the problem. There's good and there's bad on both sides. But I still would rather take my chances outside of it rather than within it in the current state that it's in.
Well, we talked in the first hour about with Paul Smith, who's city councillor for the Labour Party here in Bristol, about problems with the electoral system, quite a lot of them as well, with something like 5 million young people who are entitled to vote simply not able or willing to register with the new system for voting registration. And I noticed yesterday in the Daily Mirror, I think it was, Ben Glaze reporting that bungling EU referendum chiefs have been sending postal votes to foreigners who are actually banned from taking part. The blunder was revealed after top Tory Brexiter Ian Duncan-Smith demanded to know if foreigners had been sent voting material despite being banned. Citizens from EU countries except Ireland, Malta and Cyprus can't vote in the June the 23rd poll, but some living in Britain were sent polling cards by mistake, apparently.
That's right. Now, I mean, okay, the authorities are saying, well, they're going to basically make those cards null and void. They won't be able to vote. They won't count. But it does speak something about the, well, claimed sloppiness.
Just drilling a little bit more into that article, it's a bit close to home here in Bristol because the Electoral Commission said the IT glitch, an IT glitch was to blame. Great, isn't it, when we have these IT glitches with an election and we think, oh, well, maybe that was the wrong result there, with officials blaming council software produced by Gloucestershire-based firm Express. That's the letter X-P-R-E-S-S. Gloucestershire-based firm Express Software has been sending the electoral, I guess this is postal voting forms, off to the wrong people, Martin.
Been picked up and something will be done about it. It's going to be very interesting to see how it will play out because I think it's fairly clear that Scotland is going to vote to stay. It's quite clear that the Republicans and Nationalists in Northern Ireland will vote to stay. The Republic of Ireland has just been through a huge mincer to try and stay in the euro. Maybe they shouldn't have done that, but they've done it. So they've made huge sacrifices to stay in the euro. They're not going to be happy if the Loyalists, because they'll probably vote with their right-wing Tory allies to leave, vote to leave. What will happen in Wales will be very interesting, but of course in South Wales they're very dependent upon EU subsidy, and they've got to believe that the Tories will replace that subsidy. Another thing that really hasn't really people haven't talked about, we pay into the EU, but Norway and Switzerland both pay into the EU anyway, because even though they're outside the EU, because that's the deal that you have to do if you want access to the single market. I understand Michael Gove doesn't want access to the single market, but then some of the other people in the Brexit camp do. Frankly, the economic arguments are all over the place. Let's not even talk about them. Let's come back to the fundamental politics. You say that Britain was a democratic country. I never accept that Britain was a democratic country, and nor would Irish Republicans have ever accepted that. So, and therefore the idea that somehow the European Union is an undemocratic imposition on a democratic Britain is an illusion,
Martin,
of middle-class people,
Martin,
in the south-east of England.
What about the general election in 1945? Very, very unexpected result and massive changes to the country in 45.
Yes, indeed. And under first past the post, the Labour Party had an overall majority and was able to carry stuff through. That's a long time ago, Tony. Those reforms are dead. They were killed off in the 1970s, not by the EU, but by Margaret Thatcher and the Americans who supported her.
The 1980s.
Well, indeed, yes, from the 70s onwards. The real threat facing us is NATO. NATO is actually a terrorist organisation. Police investigations in Italy have shown that NATO intelligence services were behind the Bologna bombing, were behind the kidnapping of Aldo Moro, etc, etc. Now, people in southern Europe who've got much more serious political understanding of this than we've got, don't forget they were occupied during the war. They've had to fight, they've had the strategies of tension imposed on them by MI6. We are basically a privileged relationship with the Americans, and Britain has been pushed into the European Union by the Americans to sabotage Franco-German cooperation. So in many ways, you're probably right, French socialists would quite happily see us out. But the Scots will want to stay, the Irish will want to stay, the Welsh will probably want to stay. So we're going to press the button on the breakup of the United Kingdom. Possibly a good thing, maybe a very good thing, but it's going to rock the boat. If people think we're going to leave the EU and it's all going to be fine and we'll just walk away, that's completely wrong. It's possibly going to be the straw that breaks the camel's back of the City of London-based banking system. So here we go, let's rip it all down, but don't cry for your mummy when we get there. I think that Brexit may well win. But don't cry for mummies when your face hits the windscreen.
Interesting, fascinating. But also, Martin, of course, it could lead to the breakup of the European Union, some people are saying.
It could.
Not just the United Kingdom. Anyway, let's get back to Andy, because he's been sitting there patiently on the line there. Andy, can you just take us through some of your... Because I'm off to the Bilderberg Conference. We'll be doing this show, hopefully live from Dresden next week. And I wonder what your take is on them and their role in all this, because it's been pretty much shown... there's a certain amount of evidence that the European Union... United States of Europe project has been, they've been a large part of all of this.
Yeah, I mean, they have. And I mean, when Christine Lagarde of the IMF starts telling Britain why we must stay in the EU, what she doesn't say in the same breath is, you know, she's a big supporter of Bilderberg, so she's got her own agendas that need to keep us in. One thing I find fascinating is that despite the fact that many of our prime ministers have attended Bilderberg, and, you know, that's Blair, Brown, Cameron, Thatcher, Heath, you know, we're talking top stuff here. People still shrug the Bilderbergs off as, it's just a nice place for them to go. It has no influence. Well, it clearly does, because you wouldn't spend that amount of time and money putting on something like this if it had no influence. And as we mentioned earlier on, it has actually been admitted by insiders that they do set policy. And basically, Bilderberg attendees, I think they're all given about 10 minutes each to speak around the table. You know, they are basically mandated to implement any decisions, as it were, that come out of those meetings. So they don't just walk out of them and forget it. This is really what is shaping the world. And when you look at the high-end corporate people involved as well, this is when you realise the establishment, there is really no divide between politicians and corporatists. I mean, the current chairman is Henry de Castries. You know, he's currently the CEO of AXA, the huge international insurance firm. So we're talking about people who are right up at the very top there with enormous influence, and yet they're telling us that we mustn't know what goes on. Chatham House rules, as they always say, when clearly those decisions are influencing us. So it's an undemocratic organisation, but effectively, although they say the people that attend are paying for themselves to attend, we're all funding it at the end of the day. And to then be told that we cannot have transparency just flies in the face of the nonsense that they come out with at other times. Point the finger at, you know, groups that are not transparent. So there is hypocrisy. Martin is right to identify the fact, yeah, there's big problems with British democracy, unquestionably. And, you know, we're talking about lack of transparency in the EU. Absolutely, there's lack of transparency in the Bilderbergs. There's lack of transparency in power over here in this country. None of it's right. And just because, you know, there's hypocrisy going on here doesn't mean we shouldn't highlight all of them for needing reform. But I still think when you look at the power that people like the Bilderbergs have within the EU and then all the other foundations that underpin it, which are highly dubious, it's still far less democratic than what we've got over here, even though, yes, we do have problems and we need to get it sorted out.
And Andy, I wonder if you could just round up with telling us how people can find your work and follow some of your articles, that sort of thing.
Yeah, sure. I mean, if you want to know what I think about the EU, there's currently a couple of quite long articles on my website. So if you look up truthagenda.org, you'll find some of my articles about this and other stuff, the Brussels attacks, the French attacks, you know, I've got some views on there and all kinds of other things. And if you want to find out where I'm speaking next and about the publications, just go onto the website, truthagenda.org, and you'll find out where I'm coming from.
Hello, Andy.
Hi there, I'm still here.
Yeah, sorry, there was a bit of crackle there. Just remind us of your website once more.
Yep, so it's the three W's and it's truthagenda.org. truthagenda.org.
Yeah, I think maybe you said it about 10 times there, I'm not even sure.
Anyway, well, hopefully people are getting it.
Anyway, Andy, thanks very much for joining us on The Politics Show.
Been a pleasure, thank you.
You can listen again to any shows at bcfmradio.com. Leave comments about your favourite programmes. BCFM 93.2, your interactive station, 24 hours a day.
Martin, inquest, second inquest into Cheryl James' death at Deep Cut Barracks today. There's been all sorts of pain for the families involved here. And what struck me as most incredible was vast amounts of public money being spent on this report done by Nicholas Blake QC back in 2006 that actually said these were suicide. It's now becoming absolutely clear it was nothing of the sort.
Well, it's a cover-up, another cover-up. We all know that, don't we?
Low morale, he said, Nicholas Blake. The review has concluded, and I quote him, on the balance of probabilities that these deaths were self-inflicted. Well, there was some bits and pieces have come out in this particular inquest. Corporal Ian Wilkinson, one of the last people to see Private Cheryl James alive in November 1995 at Deep Cut, which I should remind people was a British Army training base. The inquest heard Corporal Wilkinson was not officially spoken to about the incident until 2003, unbelievably. His colleague, Sergeant Phil Wood, arrived on foot a short time after him and found the gate unmanned and unguarded. I mean, that's 3 years after the death. So the main gate on this army base, there was no guards on it that day. And we heard also that, this is from Forces TV, an article just a couple of days ago, a Deep Cut commanding officer knew that NCOs were breaking the rules. A former commanding officer at Deep Cut Barracks told an inquest NCOs were banned from fraternising sexually with young trainees, but he knew some were breaking the rules. Nigel Jostling, with a J, not a G, has been giving evidence at the inquest into the death of Private Cheryl James in 1995. He was commanding officer at the camp when two recruits were found shot dead. Mr. Jostling added that he often thought about whether he should have fallen on his sword because of the regime he was asked to take charge of, and obviously he wasn't just asked to take charge of it, he was in charge while some of these deaths took place. It comes after the inquest heard that female recruits at Deep Cut Barracks were told to keep their mouths shut after Private James's body was found. Now, it seems that there was murder and rape going on at this barracks, Martin, that Mr. Nigel Jostling was the commanding officer of.
Well, it may be so, and if it is so, let's have the truth. There's not a lot to be said about this other than that, you know, it's a very dirty business and we want to know the truth about it.
Well, the Army has apologised to the family of Private James, but, I mean, it does fit a pattern, doesn't it? Looking at from the top of the hour, I was talking about things like the Hillsborough disaster, the Jimmy Savile scandal, where it does seem that there is a deliberate attempt immediately to cover these things up, and there's no acknowledgement that people in charge may be pliable idiots, but they shouldn't be in charge because they're just not responsible enough to be running these institutions.
Well, I mean, the wider political point you might make is about British British inquiries are not regarded as independent. They were always a bit of a whitewash, but they're no longer judicial. They're essentially political, which is why the Pat Finucane Centre in Northern Ireland wants an inquiry into what went on over the years of collusion between the Loyalist paramilitaries and the British armed forces, leading to hundreds of deaths. But they don't want a British public inquiry because they simply don't trust a British public inquiry to do the job. And that's nothing to do with the EU. It's just to do with Britain being a sort of rubbish place where this kind of stuff is tolerated.
The emphasis in the Inquiries Act, which I think I'm right in saying is 2005, came out the same year as the 7/7 London bombings, is that the government minister, rather than the judge, sets the bounds of the inquiry. So you all say you're allowed to look into this, but not into this. Now, that does seem as if political power is encroaching into the judiciary, and this might be one of the things that's causing these problems.
Well, yeah, but if you think back to the original Bloody Sunday inquiry or whatever, it was not adequate. Inquiries run by governments, even at arm's length, are often whitewashes, but they're even more whitewashes now than they used to be. The culture of secrecy and cover-up, and don't forget the constant drumbeat of we're being threatened by terrorists, you know, the same terrorists that were armed and training in Syria are supposedly threatening us, and of course they probably are, but they're being who's directing and pushing all of this from above, and I think you'll find that it's not the EU fisheries ministers, it's the British secret services.
Birmingham 6 I mentioned, and we've got another inquest starting into that. What's your take on the Birmingham 6?
Well, they obviously didn't do it, and there's a very interesting article by Chris Mullen in The Guardian this week, because he obviously was campaigned on their behalf for many years, and there's actually an ex-IRA intelligence officer who's willing to come over and give evidence about the attack. The IRA admitted they did it in 1985. They apologised. What apologies mean, I really don't know in these circumstances. But it is possible to get to the bottom of it. Apparently, according to Chris Mullen, two of those involved are dead, and two others were so peripherally involved that there will be no evidence to be used against them. And don't forget, even if they were convicted, there's a deal been done about people who were involved in these activities before the peace process. And I think, of course, we're going on about Birmingham, but we haven't mentioned about 7/7, or we did just mention it. More people died there. More people died in Bologna in 1980. 86 people died, and we think, the Italian police think, that NATO intelligence services were behind that, which will include the British Special Services.
If you'd have been watching your television on the 18th of March 1991, you'd have seen this documentary transmitted by World in Action about the Birmingham Six.
These are the faces of the men convicted of Britain's worst ever terrorist attack, the Birmingham pub bombings in 1974, in which 21 people died. These are the faces of the same men after 16 years of wrongful imprisonment, the gravest miscarriage of justice in living memory. Tonight, they tell their story in their own words.
Now, I know that no system of law in this world is perfect, and obviously they can make mistakes. What rankles in our case that it took so long, 16 years? They've known for a long, long time that we were innocent.
They could pay me £20 million, wouldn't compensate me for what they've done.
I'm about 16 years in prison. Now, I'll say this, prison can make people very bitter, but I'm not bitter now, because I couldn't love the bitterness, because the way I look at it is, if you're going to be bitter, it'll make you ill. And you can get obsessed with it, like, no.
No one can compensate someone for 16 years. It's impossible. My oldest daughter was 8 years of age when I came into prison. She has children. My daughters have children. As old as they were.
It does seem at last, though, that there may be a chance to get a bit closer to the truth. The main problem with all of these cover-ups, though, Martin, is quite often the perpetrators are dead by the time the families get justice.
Well, that's right. And in any case, what the Irish Republican movement has been calling for all along is a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, similar to what has happened in South Africa, where, for example, the Dublin and Monaghan bombs of 1972 could be looked into, which the Irish police are pretty convinced were facilitated by British intelligence agents. A lot of evil has been done. And I think a lot of evil is still being done. And the truth is always important.
Well, it is. Did mention that we might be hearing from Mike Sparks again, but that will be on Tuesday on the Dialect Show at 12 noon, so you can have a listen to him then. We don't really have time for that now. But what we do have time for, Martin, is that the media is silent as the biggest protest since the French Revolution. Well, that may be an exaggeration. But anyway, they're sweeping France right now. The country prepares to host 2 million visitors to the showpiece Euro 26 football championship in a couple of weeks' time, but they've got labour strikes at oil refineries, nuclear power plants, fuel shortages, paralysing aviation and public transport system, violent street protests, nationwide riots and a state of emergency until the end of July to cover the Tour de France, even, has proved a major headache for François Hollande, the least popular president since polls began in France. Does seem that things are being censored, effectively, that we should be getting reports on our nightly news about some of the things that are going on over there. We haven't, though, have we?
Well, we don't. I mean, as you said earlier, there's an awful lot of rubbish that people spend their time on. So when all the energy and oxygen that we've got to discuss politics is being taken up with Brexit, which is largely irrelevant. Meanwhile, of course, we're actually at war in Syria, at war in Russia, and there's an uprising going on in France, but we wouldn't know about it because we're too obsessed with our own little stuff, aren't we?
Well, there are other bit of space in the newspapers to cover this, and it has been, to be fair, been covered occasionally in some of the nationals, but it's just not getting much attention because, I suppose, a bit like the I, Daniel Blake film by Ken Loach, it's not considered to be the, inverted commas, right story. And it's now 31 years since the Battle of the Beanfield. This is an article by Andy Worthington, which he's put up just a couple of days ago. It is the 1st of June, that anniversary. So where is the spirit of dissent in Britain today, Martin?
Well, it's on this programme, Tony, even though we don't necessarily agree about everything. I think people have been beaten down over the years, very much so. But, as we saw in the riots during the first coalition government a few years ago, it only takes one spark for things to take off. Especially when you're all over Europe, you've got mass unemployment of under 25s who are the military age people. So, the potential for violence is always going to be there, isn't it?
Well, it was the 12th annual Stonehenge Free Festival, but it wasn't allowed to happen. It was a police blockade by Margaret Thatcher. And a lot of these police were actually also the same police who'd been involved in the Orgreave.
Well, indeed, and a lot of people were severely injured.
That's from the miners' strike.
Yes, right. So they were bashing up the hippies, bashing up the miners. I remember it well. I was a young person in that era, and I'm afraid some things have changed. The police have become more professional, frankly, than they were in that era. But the fundamental distribution of power in the society is as bad as it ever was, and worse.
Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7. Up next is Mukawi and Kamal's Arabian Nights. Thanks to our guests in the first hour, Cabinet Member for Homes, Labour Councillor for New Central Ward, Paul Smith. Billy Quain's in the hot seat here next week, and I hope to be reporting live from Dresden, Germany, in the Power Elite secretive annual Bilderberg Conference. Thanks to Martin Summers, you just heard there. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. You can catch this show on its show page at thisweek.org.uk. Do please join us on the Politics Show at 5 next week, and don't let the banksters get you down.
political ties, habitual eyes, alibi skies, another guy's democracy politics.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Nikki Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we're joined by author and professor Peter Kuznick. He's a professor of history and director of the award-winning Nuclear Studies Institute at American University, and he's serving a third term as distinguished lecturer with the Organization of American Historians. He's written extensively about science and politics, nuclear history, and Cold War culture, and of course he is co-author with Oliver Stone of the best-selling Untold History of the United States. Peter Kuznick, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Thanks, Vicky. Good to be here.
So, Peter, you were recently in Japan. President Barack Obama was in Japan to address the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki at the end of World War II. Tell us about the significance of this whole trip and the fact that you were there, and we'll get into some more details.
The significance about Obama's being there is really the story, the fact that he's the first American president to visit Hiroshima in 71 years is quite significant. It was a remarkable moment. I've been encouraging him to go since he first got elected, and he actually said in 2009 that he wanted to go. According to WikiLeaks documents we've gotten a hold of, Obama wanted to go in 2009, but Japanese officials discouraged him from doing so. They said it was too soon. Hatoyama was the prime minister at the time. I contacted him because I know him pretty well, and I asked him when the documents came out, you know, what do you know about this? And he said he knew nothing about it. It's the first he heard of it. In Japan, you've got bureaucrats who tend to run things above the politicians. One of the bureaucrats, or some of the bureaucrats, must have made that decision. Because Obama wanted to go. Had he gone in 2009, had he made his Prague speech from Hiroshima instead of from the Czech Republic, it would have had so much more of an impact, and maybe would have given him the momentum to actually follow through on his vision, or some aspect of his vision, of nuclear abolition. It was a great speech, and it won him the Nobel Peace Prize. I've said repeatedly that he should give that prize to the Hiboksha, to the survivors in Hiroshima, because they deserve it, and sadly, he doesn't. His own track record in recent years, the last 6 years really, has been pretty dismal, specifically on the things for which he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize.
One of the messages, my understanding, is he was calling for the end of nuclear weapons. Is that legitimate, or is, of course, spending of hundreds of billions, if not $1 trillion, on upgrading the U.S. weapons cache contradicts that? How do you perceive that?
I say that actions speak louder than words, that Obama can talk a good game. And I think he's sincere when he calls for nuclear abolition. You have to remember that he marched in Central Park in that million-person march in 1982 against nuclear weapons. He's written things, especially as a student in his Columbia days, about nuclear weapons. I think that deep in his heart of hearts, he really feels strongly about this. And he made it his signature issue in the beginning of his presidency, in the days when we still had Obama as being potentially a great president. But his actual policies have been, of late, the opposite of that. This $1 trillion modernization that he's calling for not only makes our nuclear arsenal more efficient, it makes nuclear weapons more usable. Obama has, in effect, increased the likelihood that nuclear weapons are going to be used. He has created a situation in which nuclear weapons remain a fundamental part of America's defense strategy for the next 30 years. So he says in his Hiroshima speech that we may not see nuclear abolition in my lifetime, he says. Well, he's younger than I am. The message that the people in Hiroshima get there, you have to remember that the youngest of the Hiboksha, the youngest survivors, is now 70 years old. That most of them are in their 80s and 90s. Their dream, their hope, is to see nuclear abolition, nuclear weapons abolished in their lifetime. And that's what they've committed their lives being. And I know their reaction to that was one of profound disappointment. It's one of the things that bothered them the most about Obama's speech, was his saying that we can't do it in his lifetime, or probably not in his lifetime. He said the same thing in Prague, but there's no excuse for that. As president of the United States, we could see nuclear abolition. We should have seen nuclear abolition not only in his lifetime, but in his presidency. But he dropped the ball on that, like so many other things.
Peter Kuznick, is it that he's dropping the ball, or is it that the military-industrial complex and intelligence agencies, and there are so many other forces at work with great inertia, deep state forces and so forth? I mean, you mentioned that Obama is a rhetorician. He's a gifted speaker, to be sure. But there's such a yawning gap between the rhetoric and the actions, and such a pattern of the gap. Perhaps it's not necessarily surprising that he's talking this game, and of all places in Japan, but then sort of kicking the can down the road again, turning it into the problem of future generations.
Yeah, of course, I completely agree with you on that, that he's up against very, very difficult circumstances, but that doesn't let him off the hook.
No, it ought not.
You know, if he had the backbone of John F. Kennedy, who stood up and defied those same military forces, then Obama could get these things done. But he hasn't shown the courage or the wisdom of a John Kennedy, who told his military advisors just where to get on and where to get off. If he had listened to their advice during the Cuban Missile Crisis, we wouldn't be here today. If Obama was in the White House during the Cuban Missile Crisis, we wouldn't be here today either, because he has not had that kind of courage and integrity. So, yes, it takes a lot to stand up to those people. Yes, they're deeply empowered, and they are everywhere, and they have the system, as you talk about, the deep state, that actually has a lot of influence, but it's a question of people with courage and integrity who stand up to that. There are many ways Roosevelt stood up those forces. They weren't the same military-industrial complex before the nuclear age that they are now, and they're really tremendously powerful and deeply embedded. So I recognize the kind of courage it would take for an Obama to do that. But he had a moment here, a moment where he could achieve real greatness. When the eyes of the world were on him, when he was bravely the first American president to ever go to Hiroshima, when already his critics were attacking him, and he could sacrifice a little bit of his popularity in order to at least say the right things. But if you look at his speech and you look at his visit, as I often say, I had high hopes and low expectations for this trip, and he lived down to my expectations.
Well, Peter Kuznick, we certainly see what happened to John F. Kennedy, though that's a diversion from the conversation here.
Yes, and maybe that's what he's afraid of. But we also know that even when he came into office, during his campaign, he surrounded himself. Economic policy advisors were what the New York Times referred to as a constellation of Reubenites. They were the Wall Street people he surrounded himself with. His foreign policy advisors were the likes of Robert Gates, Hillary Clinton, General Jones. So he surrounded himself with militarists and Wall Street folks. So even in that sense, he trapped himself in this web of deceit that goes beyond what he needed to do. You know, maybe that's what it takes to get elected. Maybe that's why even a Bernie Sanders, who's not a perfect candidate by any means, but at least has somewhat of a vision, is having up against these establishment forces, and why you've got Hillary Clinton as the presumptive Democratic nominee.
Well, that is certainly what the corporate media is propounding along with the DNC regarding the Clinton candidacy. I'd like to remind listeners you're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We're in conversation right now with Professor Peter Kuznick. He is co-author with Oliver Stone of the award-winning Untold History of the United States, the book and series. Peter Kuznick was recently in Japan during President Barack Obama's historic visit there, discussing the dropping of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And Peter Kuznick, let's go into that element here. Let's go into the actual historical event here that Obama, the first president to go there and actually cite this. Now, Obama didn't issue any kind of apology, number one. But two, this is taking place on the backdrop of some interesting shifts historiographically in how Americans maybe view the dropping of the bomb, and even the Japanese. Maybe you can comment on a few of those issues.
For the first time, a national poll was released, the CBS News poll, that showed that more Americans think the atomic bombing of Hiroshima was unjustified than think it was justified. In the past, the polls have usually been more like the Pew poll that was released last summer. And that poll showed 56% of Americans were in favor of the atomic bombing, 34% were opposed. But it also showed that the majority of younger Americans under the age of 30 were opposed to the atomic bombing. This poll shows 44% of Americans opposed the atomic bombing and only 43% in favor of the atomic bombing. So something has changed. mean, I'd like to think it's a reflection of the effort of my colleagues who've been out there on the hustings, educating, speaking, writing for years about this. You know, the centerpiece really of Oliver Stone and my documentary series, The Untold History of the United States, and our books, was the atomic bombing. That was really our starting point of our collaboration, Oliver and me, 20 years ago. And when we go around the country, usually, as we did with you in Oakland, the episode that we show of our documentary series is episode 3 about the atomic bombings in 1945. And we do this on campuses and high schools. You do it everywhere. Sometimes we choose other episodes, but that's usually the one that we show because we think it's so fundamental to the beginnings of this notion of the whole Cold War consensus, the whole idea of American exceptionalism, which is so central to the mythology. This was a fascinating trip by Obama. Before we get back to the survey, if I could digress on this a little bit.
Sure.
If we look at Obama's trip, first he goes to Vietnam, and he says there that we're not going to talk about the history of the war in Vietnam. Right, he's going to look forward to the future. What does that mean? Selling arms to the Vietnamese, just what the world needs. But doesn't talk about the history there at all. Then he goes to Hiroshima, and he announces two things in advance. Number one, he's not going to apologize, and two, he's not going to relitigate the decision to drop the bomb. He's not going to look back at that.
Those seem to be two key issues.
And also, if you think back to his speech welcoming the troops back from Iraq at Fort Bragg, he says the same thing there, and he explicitly, again, ties it into this notion of American exceptionalism. If Americans know the history of Vietnam, if they know the history of Hiroshima, how do you have this idea about the United States as this exceptional country that's benevolent, that's generous, that's altruistic, that only cares about spreading freedom and democracy, right? These episodes, these events that are so central to American history, give the lie to this notion of American benevolence and generosity, shows that the United States is just as fallible as other countries. However, it has more power and therefore can do more bad in the world or could do more good if it chooses to do so. And so when he greets the troops at Fort Bragg, he says, what makes Americans so exceptional, what makes us different from all other countries, is we don't go over to Iraq because we want oil or because we want, you know, to strengthen ourselves geopolitically or because we want territory. We go there because it's right, he says. And it's this obfuscation of history, this deep lying about history that allows so many Americans to keep marching forward in this blind atmosphere of not understanding what role the United States has actually played. And if we don't know the history, we can't improve it. We can't get it right. The point is not to criticize the United States for the sake of criticizing the United States. The point is to learn from the past. And the United States, because it's a country of such amnesiacs, has so little understanding of history, cannot learn from the past. If you remember the American National Report Card in 2011, June 2011, it showed that American high school seniors scored the lowest, not in math and science, which we are always talking about, they scored the lowest in U.S. history. Only 11% of American high school seniors, I recall, or 12%, was considered to be proficient in U.S. history. This is the blindness that we're dealing with, and Obama, on this trip, deliberately reinforced it.
Well, as a fellow historian, Peter Kuznick, I certainly commiserate that statistic and the really loathsome state of humanities, liberal arts education, particularly focus on history in the United States. We're going to take a brief musical break, but when we come back, we will continue this conversation with Professor Peter Kuznick. You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's show, we're joined by Professor Peter Kuznick. He is co-author with Oliver Stone of the award-winning Untold History of the United States. We've been talking about his recent trip to Japan, as well as the history of the dropping of the atomic bomb on Japan, allegedly to end World War II, but we're going to get more into that shifting historiographic myth as the program goes on. Peter Phillips?
Yeah, Peter Kuznick. I'd like to ask you a little bit about China and Obama's position around what they call the pivot, which is essentially building military bases in an encirclement of China. And, of course, his visit to Vietnam and his visit to Japan kind of reinforces that. How is China perceived today in terms of old Cold War mentalities?
In terms of Cold War mentalities, the whole Asia pivot is a replay of the containment policy during the Cold War toward Russia. And in fact, it's even militarized. When Hillary Clinton wrote her article in Foreign Policy magazine in November 2011, titled America's Pacific Century, she lays out this vision for shifting the balance of our armed forces as well as our diplomacy toward the Asia-Pacific region, toward containing China. And it was quite a militaristic vision. And it was followed up by a policy of increasing arms sales to all of the countries surrounding China. Now, you have to remember that the United States used to be the number one trading partner of all the ASEAN countries, and then it was replaced by China. So on the one hand, China is America's banker. We're enormously indebted to China. China sells a massive amount of goods in the United States as well as throughout the rest of Asia. So it's become this economic dynamo, but the United States has a schizophrenic policy toward China, where China is challenging the United States for hegemony. One of the things Obama said in his Hiroshima speech is that empires rise and fall. Maybe he was thinking about America's relation with China and the fact that China appears to be the next great empire. The United States strategy, though, is a militarized one. We've been selling massive amounts of arms, and I think just a couple of years ago, the United States was responsible for 77% of world arms sales. Much of those arms sales go to our quote-unquote allies in the region who are intent upon controlling China, containing China, challenging China. So, I mean, that's such a big part of what's going on there, but you look at the tension there. The other part that I was going to mention is the joint military exercises that the United States has with the other Asian nations. China at this point has one overseas base in Djibouti. The United States has somewhere between 800 and 1,000 overseas bases. And we're using that in order to reassert this influence and domination in the Pacific region. China has unfortunately been following, I mean, one of the things that Oliver and I say in Untold History is that we hope that China, as the next emerging empire, learns the lessons from what the United States has done wrong and adopts a very different relationship to the rest of the world than the United States did during the Pax Americana. But I'm not very optimistic about that, because China's own behavior in the South China Sea especially, and to a lesser extent the East China Sea, has been one of bullying, one of asserting its power, one of selfishness, one of greed. And by doing that, by taking this hard line and flexible stand to the other Asian nations, they're actually playing directly into the hands of America's foreign policy hawks. So that they're frightening the other Asian nations. There's enough wealth in the South China Sea for everybody to benefit and everybody to share. But the Chinese strategy has been, I think, a regressive one and an unfortunate one. And if China doesn't wake up, it's not only going to find these countries being pushed into the lap of the United States, and especially the neocons and the strategists who want to see this confrontation with China, but it's also going to be encouraging further militarization on the part of the countries around it, further arms sales, and potentially even watching some of those countries go nuclear, which to me is a terrifying prospect.
Certainly the Chinese released that they were stationing a couple of their nuclear subs in the Pacific Ocean as a defense mechanism. These, of course, are nuclear-armed submarines. says something to that exchange of blustering and war that's going on between China and the U.S. At the same time, the integration of Chinese billionaires into transnational capital and investments outside of China, and the movement of some of that huge amounts of money worldwide is an economic factor that's coming to play as well. So I think there is a contradiction here in terms of how we approach China in one way and then economically the other.
I think there's a big contradiction there, and I'm not sanguine about this. It's a dangerous situation. There's a lot of provocative rhetoric going both ways. I was recently told by a leader of a Latin American state that he went recently and met with Xi Jinping, and the first thing he did was give him a copy of Untold History. So I was glad, and he said, if you want to understand the United States, you've got to read this. So hopefully he is, and he's going to learn some of the positive lessons as well as the negative ones and rethink some of these policies. But the United States, the Chinese see that they've been the victim for the last 100 years, if not longer, and that they've been humiliated, that they've been forced to back down, that they've been treated very badly by the United States. And now they see this is their time to assert themselves and build up their military, and they've been doing that. The proportion of military spending as a proportion of gross domestic product is not out of line with what's happening with other countries, Japan and other countries. Have been increasing their military spending, and they've been acting in a belligerent and hostile fashion toward other Asian nations. There's no need for that. There's enough wealth to go around. The Chinese can prosper sufficiently and have been without this kind of provocative militaristic policy, which is just going to backfire.
Well, Peter Kuznick, let's go back historically. Barack Obama was in Japan talking about the use of the atomic bomb. And again, this is something that you have been discussing for a very, very long time in your work, including the decision to drop the bomb made by Harry Truman. And Truman called the obliteration of Hiroshima the greatest thing in history.
Yeah.
Gives you some perspective there. You and Oliver Stone wrote a piece for the LA Times, so it's heartening to see that you've been getting more attention lately. But let's get right to the root of this, right? The bombing of Hiroshima changed the world, but it didn't end World War II, is the title of your piece. I just would like for you to make that point, clarify that for listeners as to what your position is, because there still are a few people, more than a few people in the historical profession, that are not necessarily okay with that interpretation. So perhaps you can elaborate.
Yes. Obama, in his speech, said a couple of interesting things. He said, we have a responsibility to look directly into the eye of history and ask what we must do differently to curb such suffering again. He says, we can tell our children a different story. I was hoping he would do so. However, what Obama also says is the World War reached its brutal end in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. That's the fundamental myth of the Pacific War, that the atomic bombs were necessary, that they forced Japan's surrender. If Japan had not surrendered, the United States would have had to invade Japan and would have lost a 500,000 to 1 million men in the process, and even more Japanese would have been killed. So therefore, ergo, the atomic bombs were actually a humane act by the United States because they saved American and Japanese lives. That's the official narrative. That's the lesson. And that's also the lie that Obama reinforced during his Hiroshima speech. One of the things that I found most disturbing. The reality is quite to the contrary, and this is something that I've been writing about for a long time, and Oliver and I emphasize, and a lot of my colleagues have been writing about. And the reality is that beginning with the Battle of Saipan, the Japan's defeat in July of 44 at Saipan, Japanese leaders recognized that they could not win the war militarily. In February of 1945, Prince Konoe, the former prime minister, writes Emperor Hirohito and says, I regret to say that defeat is inevitable. The challenge for us is how to avoid a communist revolution when we surrender. In the next few months, the Japan War Council meets in mid-May in Tokyo, and they decide at that point, what they say there explicitly, is that Soviet entry into the war will be the end of the Japanese Empire. They're very, very explicit about that. They decided at that meeting that they actually have to approach the Soviets to try to get them better surrender terms. The Soviets were neutral up to that point. What the Japanese didn't know was that at Yalta in February, Roosevelt had extracted a promise from Stalin to come into the Pacific War 3 months after the end of the war in Europe. And the United States had offered a lot of concessions to the Russians for doing so. So the Russians were having to have their own game that they're playing here. The Japanese approach the Russians, and former Ambassador Hirota meets with Soviet Ambassador in Tokyo, Malik, in early June several times, and the Soviets draw the conclusion in early June that the Japanese are desperate to surrender. And so they knew what the situation was, but Stalin wants to come in order to secure what he had been promised. So the Americans had broken the Japanese codes. We were intercepting their cables. The message was repeated over and over again that the main obstacle to surrender is the U.S. demand for unconditional surrender. So what we know in the spring and summer of 45 is that there are two ways to get Japan to surrender without using atomic bombs. One is to change the surrender terms to let Japan know that they could keep the emperor. The emperor to them was a god. And as General MacArthur's Southwest Pacific Command says in the summer of 1945, says the execution of the emperor to them would be like the crucifixion of Christ to us. All would fight to die like ants.
Indeed, Peter Kuznick, you write about that explicitly in your book, Untold History.
Yes, because the case is so clear. The evidence is overwhelming on this. It's just a question of getting it to the American people. So one thing is to change the surrender terms, let them keep the emperor, which most of Truman's advisors were urging him to do. And the second is to wait for the Soviet invasion, which was going to begin around August 8th or August 9th. Truman said he went to Potsdam primarily to make sure the Russians were coming into the war. And he gets the guarantee the first day from Stalin. And he writes in his journal on August 17th, Stalin will be in the Jap War by August 15th. Finny Japs when that occurs. Finny Japs. He says he knew the Japs are finished. He writes home to his wife, Beth, the next day, says the Russians are coming in, we'll end the war a year sooner now. Think of the boys who won't be killed. He knows the Japanese are trying to surrender. He refers to the intercepted July 18th telegram as, quote, the telegram from the Jap emperor asking for peace. I mean, the evidence is overwhelming that Truman knew that the war was about to end, that the atomic bombs were not needed. His advisors agreed. And not only that, but America's military leaders are on record agreeing also. We don't know. We don't have an account of what they told Truman beforehand. But we do know that seven of America's eight five-star admirals and generals who had their fifth star in 1945, seven of eight are on record as saying the atomic bombs were militarily unnecessary, morally reprehensible, or in most cases, both. And so, you know, we're talking about Eisenhower, MacArthur, Leahy, Nimitz, King, Arnold, Halsey. And the eighth was General Marshall, and he said that the Soviet invasion might itself lever the Japanese into surrender. So even though he's not on record as saying that the atomic bombs weren't necessary like the other ones are, he's implied it as well.
Peter Kuznick, I'm going to ask you the historically unfair what-if question. Franklin Roosevelt, had he lived, what do you think his take on such might be?
FDR was ambivalent and unclear about it. He spoke to several people. The first time when he and Churchill discussed it, they talked about the possibility of the bombing after a warning or a demonstration. And Roosevelt spoke to several people about that. He spoke to Sachs, Alexander Sachs. He spoke to Felix Frankfurter. And he spoke to several people, and his message was always the same, that we might end up using this, but we would try to find a way to minimize the damage. You know, but Truman was in a difficult position. He was only vice president for 82 days. before Roosevelt died. Roosevelt didn't talk to him at all about anything of substance. In fact, Truman did not even know that the United States was developing an atomic bomb when he became president. He'd been vice president for almost 3 months. Nobody had enough respect or regard for Truman to even let him in on the secret that the U.S. was developing an atomic bomb. Truman was a non-entity, really.
We're speaking with Professor Peter Kuznick, historian at American University, co-author with Oliver Stone of The Untold History of the United States. I'm Mickey Helf with Peter Phillips. You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. After this brief musical break, we'll continue our conversation with Peter Kuznick. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today we're speaking with historian and author Peter Kuznick from American University. He's co-author with Oliver Stone of The Untold History of the United States. Peter Kuznick was recently in Japan at the same time that President Barack Obama was there to discuss the decision of dropping the atomic bomb on Hiroshima at the ending of World War II. And of course, Peter Kuznick, along with Oliver Stone, have argued for some time that that bombing wasn't actually necessary. We just heard Peter Kuznick talking about that issue, laying that out. And Peter Kuznick, we ended talking about Truman as a character, but let's shift a little bit as to, you know, what was established by the dropping of the bomb at the end of World War II. Seems like a shot across the bow, perhaps, at the Soviet Union and sparks this Cold War. So let's maybe go into a tiny bit of that, and then let's talk about some of the other issues that have gone on as a result of the ending of the war in Japan with U.S.-Japanese relations.
Okay, sounds good. So we were talking about the decision to drop the bomb and why it was totally indefensible in every sense. So the United States drops the bomb on Hiroshima on August 6th. We dropped the bomb on Nagasaki at 11:02 on August 9th. But before that bomb was dropped, the Soviets do invade at midnight on August 8th, and the Soviets go from Manchuria, Korea, the Kuril Islands, and the Japanese Prime Minister Suzuki was asked on August 10th why the Japanese had us surrender so quickly. And he says that the Soviets have overwhelmed us, and tomorrow they'll be in Hokkaido. The foundation of Japan will be destroyed, and Japan must surrender when it can still surrender to the United States. The Japanese realized that they had some chance of keeping their empire and at least their capitalist system. If the United States was the occupying force, they had no chance if the Soviets were the occupying force. But again, the Americans who believe that the atomic bomb ended the war don't understand that, that it was the Soviet invasion that ended the war, not the atomic bomb. So, but why, if the United States did not need to drop atomic bombs, did we choose to do so? Truman is not particularly bloodthirsty. He doesn't get satisfaction out of killing innocent women and children. That's not who he was, or the American, other American leaders during the war. But the Cold War was already emerging.
What Truman, about characters like Burns?
Well, yeah, Truman takes office on April 12th, late in the night on April 12th, the day that Roosevelt dies, and gets sworn in. First day in office is April 13th. The person he turns to for advice on April 13th was Jimmy Burns from South Carolina. Secretary of the Navy Forrestal flew Burns up in his own private plane from South Carolina to meet with Truman. And Truman says to him, as he did to everybody in the beginning, I have no idea what's going on. I shouldn't be in this office. I'm not a big enough man. I'm not smart enough. And he says, Jimmy, tell me everything you know. Burns had been one of his few allies in the Senate because Truman was dismissed by the other senators as a senator from Pendergast because he was the product of a corrupt political machine. And so most of them shunned him, but Burns was befriended him right from the beginning in the Senate. And when Burns comes up here, Truman asks him to tell him everything that's going on in the world, and Burns says to him that the Soviets have been breaking their agreements. first thing he says about the bomb, calls it, Truman writes in his memoir, a weapon great enough to destroy the whole world. So right from the very beginning, so another important aspect of this story, the Americans knew that the atomic bomb that they were using in Hiroshima was the most primitive of the atomic bombs. Robert Oppenheimer, the leading scientist of Los Alamos, had told American leaders on May 31st that within 3 years, we're likely going to have bombs up to 7,000 times as powerful as the bomb that's going to destroy Hiroshima. And so Truman knew that, and on at least three occasions, Truman refers to the atomic bomb as this apocalyptic weapon that could destroy the world, which it actually is and does turn into. So on April 13th, Truman's his first day in office, by the time he meets with Molotov 10 days later, he's completely reversed the mindset around Roosevelt's relationship with the Russians. Roosevelt's last cable, he says to Churchill, these little issues between us and the Soviets pop up every day and they seem to all get resolved. Let's not make an issue of them. Let's go on with our policy of friendship toward the Soviet Union. Roosevelt had this vision of what he called four policemen that he lays out in 1942 and that he still adhered to. And it was the idea that the Americans, the British, the Chinese, and the Soviets would maintain peace and stability in the post-war world. Roosevelt believed in that to the end. However, Truman comes in there, listens to Burns and Forrestal and these other right-wingers, and adopts a hardline confrontation policy toward the Soviets overnight. And when Molotov comes to see him on April 23rd at the White House, Truman treats him terribly, accuses the Soviets of having broken all their commitments and agreements, especially over Poland. And Molotov says, I've never been spoken to that way in my life. Truman says, carry out your agreements. You won't have to be spoken to like that. Truman was this little man who thought that he could get by with bluster, sort of like Trump in some ways, rather than knowledge or in any kind of negotiating and understanding how the world looks through the other side's eyes. Truman then goes in to see his aides, and he brags, I gave it to him, 1-2 to the jaw. You know, that's a little tough guy. This is the Truman whose father, John Peanuts Truman, who was about 5 feet 3 inches tall in Missouri, he'd go around beating up guys a foot taller because he wanted to show how tough he was. And Truman, who was not macho in that way and was not approved by his father, wanted to show how tough he was as well. But this kind of stupid blindness, myopic approach was the opposite of what was needed at the start of the Cold War. The atomic bombs reinforced that narrative in Soviet eyes. The Soviets understood better than anybody how desperate the Japanese were to surrender. The Soviets understood that there was no military reason to use the atomic bomb, and they interpreted as if they were the target, that this was Truman's way of sending a warning to the Soviet Union that if the Soviets interfered with American plans in Europe or Asia, this is what they were going to get. And that's the way the Soviets interpreted it, and that's the way that many American leaders saw it. Leslie Groves, the head of the Manhattan Project, says, I didn't go along with any of this stuff about the Russians being our gallant allies. He said, from the time I took over this project, I treated it, the Manhattan Project, to build a bomb as if the Soviets were our enemies and that the project was directed toward them. He says to Joseph Rotblat, you know, they tells him explicitly that the bomb is going to be used to send a warning to the Soviets. Jimmy Burns, when he meets with American scientists in South Carolina on May 28th, says to Leo Szilard, who is Hungarian, says, you don't want to see the Soviets in Hungary, do you? We're going to use this in order to roll back the Soviets in Europe. So the atomic bomb was an instrumental aspect of the Cold War from the very beginning and was one of the things that alerted the Soviets, the Soviet leaders, to the fact that the Truman presidency was going to be fundamentally different than Roosevelt's vision for world peace, or than the vision that former Vice President Henry Wallace also expressed and embodied toward the Soviets.
Peter, in April of 45, the U.S. invaded Okinawa, and it was a major battle, and lots of lives were lost. So most of the military believed that we were going to have to invade Japan in order to end the war, and that what they were saying would cost 500,000 or 1 million U.S. lives. How do you respond to people that say that?
First of all, most of the military did not believe that, actually. If you look at the actual record about what they were predicting in terms of American casualties, the highest number we were able to, official number of estimated casualties we were able to find was 46,000. Truman writes in his memoir that Marshall told him that we would lose a 500,000 American men in an invasion, but there's no record to support that.
And as years go by, the number gets bigger and bigger, right, mythologically.
Exactly. And if, Truman and Grove's first statement says, we saved thousands of American lives. Then it goes up to tens of thousands, then hundreds of thousands, then 500,000. Then Truman finally later says 1,000,000 American lives were saved. And George H.W. Bush says it saved millions of American lives. The highest estimate I've heard is 6 million, 1 million Americans and 5 million Japanese. So, yeah, I mean, that, even that is part of the mythology. Although if the United States did invade, probably there would have been heavy casualties, American and Japanese. It would have been a disastrous thing. Nobody's saying we should have invaded instead of using the atomic bomb. By the time the Americans developed the bomb, the invasion was effectively off the table. There were two ways we could end the war, through negotiations and compromise of some sort, or by using the atomic bombs. And the you have to remember that we dropped bombs in Hiroshima on August 6th and Nagasaki on August 9th to avoid an invasion, supposedly, officially, that wasn't supposed to begin until November 1st. And that was the invasion of Kyushu. The main invasion of the Japanese home island was not going to begin till March or April of 1946. So, and MacArthur said American losses were going to be very, very limited and minimal in that period. But Admiral Leahy, who chaired the meetings of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, was Truman's personal chief of staff, Leahy says, I could see no reason from a national defense point of view for an invasion of an already thoroughly defeated Japan. And so, I mean, Leahy's comments are remarkable on this. He said the Japanese were already defeated and ready to surrender. The use of this barbarous weapon in Hiroshima and Nagasaki was of no material assistance in our war against Japan. In being the first to use it, we adopted an ethical standard common to the barbarians of the Dark Ages. Yeah, Leahy was the most outraged. He later told Jonathan Daniels, who wrote a biography of Truman, he says, Truman told me it was agreed that they would use it only to hit military objectives. Of course, then they went ahead and killed as many women and children as they could, which was just what they wanted all the time. So, I mean, talk about the anger in the, you know, Leahy, Eisenhower. These people were appalled that the U.S. used nuclear weapons.
We're speaking with historian Peter Kuznick, co-author with Oliver Stone of The Untold History of the United States. He was recently in Japan during President Barack Obama's visit, and we will continue our conversation with Peter Kuznick after this brief musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We're speaking with historian and author Peter Kuznick for today's program. He's co-author with Oliver Stone of The Untold History of the United States. Peter Kuznick, you were again on an historical roll there before the last break. There's so much to discuss, and you wanted to complete a few of your thoughts.
Yes, to be fair, I should acknowledge that there are some shining intellects and scholars and exemplary human beings who disagree with me on this. One recently said when he endorsed Donald Trump, he says, we got to talk about this presidential crap just for a minute here. I'll tell you who they said wasn't presidential. I don't even know what the hell presidential means, but they told him he wasn't presidential. And that guy they told all these people they wanted to say, you're not presidential, that guy was Harry Truman. And Harry Truman, with what he did in dropping and having the guts to drop the bomb in 1944, saved millions of American lives. And that's what Harry Truman did. And he became one of the three great presidents of the United States. And here's a man who would do the same thing, Donald Trump, because he's going to become one of the four great presidents of the United States. And who was that shining intellect? Bobby Knight, the former basketball coach at Indiana University.
Okay.
But he's got bedfellows. And one of the other ignoramuses who next to nothing about this topic but likes to shoot off his mouth is Sean Wilentz. Sean Wilentz, the esteemed historian of the 19th century from Princeton, is a big supporter of the dropping of the atomic bomb. The same Sean Wilentz who not only attacks Oliver and me, but has attacked Howard Zinn, Michael Kazin.
He's a defender of official establishment narrative.
He had an ethical bypass a few decades ago, and he didn't start off that bad, but he's gotten worse and worse. He wrote one piece attacking Snowden, Assange, and Chelsea Manning, right? I mean, it's just appalling.
Well, propagandists, certainly for state and establishment interests, that's right. To be sure, and that's the role often that academics play. You obviously are taking a different path.
But the truth gets out there, despite everything we're up against, despite the official narratives, despite the spin machines and the noise machines. Look, Reese, at the National Museum of the U.S. Navy in Washington, D.C., has a display on the atomic bombing. And it says, the vast destruction wreaked by the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the loss of 135,000 people made little impact on the Japanese military. However, the Soviet invasion of Manchuria on August 9th changed their minds. So even the official U.S. Navy Museum now tells a story consistent with what we've been arguing all along. And now, finally, the majority of Americans are saying in this latest poll that the atomic bombings were wrong. Once we can begin to deal honestly with our history, we can begin to change it. We can begin to make this a better world. The argument that Oliver and I make is that everybody's got a view of history and that people are in some ways limited by their view of history. And to the extent that students and young people or older people think that the way the world turned out is the only way it could have turned out, to that extent they can't dream, they can't imagine a different future. You know, our world now, in which the richest 62 people have more wealth than the poorest 3.6 billion people, is unconscionable. Yet many people think that they couldn't be any different. Well, what we're trying to say, and what you've been trying to say, is that this is not a decent world or a rational world or a just world or the way the world should be. We have to make this a much better world, and we can begin by changing people's understanding of the past so they can begin to imagine a very, very different kind of future. And that's what Oliver and I and you and Peter have been trying to do.
You and I think Noam Chomsky were part of a group of scholars that called for closing the U.S. bases in Okinawa, partly stimulated by the rape of a young woman by a U.S. Marine there. But also, I mean, would you favor dismantling the pivot?
Absolutely. The Okinawa bases, I've only been there twice. The first time in 2013, I went with Oliver Stone to Okinawa, and we did a speaking tour there in support of the anti-base movement. And then I went back the following year with Sadako Norimatsu from Vancouver and Joseph Gerson from the American Friends Service Committee. And we again met with the anti-base activists and did some public events there. The base situation in Okinawa is untenable. During the war, the bloodiest battle of the war was fought there in Okinawa. They were brutalized and victimized by the Japanese troops as well as by the Americans. And you go there and you go into the caves there where the civilians were hiding out. And very often the civilians were forced out of those caves by the Japanese troops, or in many cases murdered them. In some cases, if there were children crying, they would force the parents to kill their own children so that they wouldn't be detected by the Americans. A lot of stories of real cowardice on the part of the Japanese troops and terrible treatment of the Okinawans. And then after the war, Okinawa was occupied by the U.S. military, The Marines were everywhere in Okinawa, and again, people there were treated terribly. Then finally, in 1972, Okinawa reverts back to the Japanese under Sato, who was the prime minister. You've got to realize that the kind of family background that the current prime minister Abe has. His grandfather was Kishi, who was the prime minister in the 50s. He was a former Class A war criminal who was then let off the hook by the Americans, and becomes prime minister. As prime minister, he signs AMPO in 1960, the U.S.-Japan Security Pact, that was so unpopular that there was a mass uprising, and he was thrown out of office as a result. Then his younger brother, Sato, becomes prime minister, and he oversees the reversion, but conducts and carries out all of these secret deals. Japan has these three anti-nuclear principles, and Sato tells the Americans, these are ignore them. You know, I'm just doing this for a show. And he says you can, under emergency circumstances, you can store your nuclear weapons in Japan, although that was another of these secret agreements. And Sato, for this, wins the Nobel Peace Prize. He wins it one year, and Henry Kissinger the next, or the other way around. But he and Kissinger win it back to back.
And so Obama is following in their footsteps?
Not as bad. It's not as bad, but, you know, it's just a real disappointment because Obama had potential greatness. That's the sad thing about Obama. Clearly, Kissinger never did, from a, you know, moral standpoint, and Sato never did in any way. Obama is a disappointment to us because Obama knows better, and Obama could, I think, potentially have been a great president and has snatched mediocrity from the jaws of greatness.
Well, Peter Kuznick, we have a few minutes left, and I want to take advantage of not only your expertise in these areas, but the fact that you were just in Japan surrounding this historic issue. And what was your reading of the Japanese public? What was your reading among the Japanese, if you could get one, regarding Obama's visit and particularly his remarks?
Yeah, interesting question. I think, according to a poll conducted by Kyoto News, 98% of the Japanese approved of Obama's visit. That's pretty astounding. We know that, according to recent polls, about 80% of Japanese think the atomic bombs were wrong, and about 12% approve of the atomic bombings. And they see Obama's visit. It was pitched there and covered there much of the same way it was in the U.S. This was a statement calling for nuclear abolition, and that Obama did a good thing by going. I had dinner with several of the leaders of Hidankyo, which is the Japan Association of Atomic Bomb Sufferers. These are the representatives of these survivors who have been in the forefront of the international effort to abolish nuclear weapons. And what they made clear to me, which I knew anyway, was that the Hidankyo, the survivors group, is split into two main factions. One group, the ones who are dreamers about nuclear abolition, were happy that Obama came and thought that his statement of these lofty principles was more than enough. The other group were the realists who really want to see nuclear abolition, were very disappointed with Obama's visit. They were disappointed in that Obama said nothing concrete or immediate, took no steps to bring about nuclear abolition or even advance the cause. That, in effect, Obama's going the opposite direction. They, like we, wanted to see immediate cuts to the U.S. nuclear arsenal. They, like we, wanted to see him announce that he was going to reverse his trillion-dollar nuclear modernization program that's intended to make nuclear weapons more usable. So they were very disappointed. If you recall the visuals there, Obama, after he finished his speech, shook hands with two of the survivors. The first was a man named Tsuboi. Mr. Tsuboi, 91 years old, is from Hiroshima, and he's very moderate in his views and already said Obama doesn't need to apologize. He doesn't want an apology. So he's a moderate leader in Hiroshima. The second one who Obama met with was a Mori-san, Mr. Mori. Mr. Mori was invited by the U.S. He's a survivor of the bombing who has spent his last few decades trying to apologize for the U.S. POWs who were killed there. And in fact, he's gone to the families to apologize. He's tried to spend his whole time doing research about the American POWs. So he is persona non grata among the Hibakusha in Hiroshima, because his job is to defend U.S. policy and apologize for what the Japanese did to the American prisoners who were there. So they were put in the front row very, very visibly so that Obama could shake hands with them, and he embraced Maury when Maury broke down. But back in the third row were Tanaka-san and Iwasa-san, who were the real leaders of Hidankyo, who were outspoken critics, who were not only demanded an apology, but also demanded concrete steps toward nuclear abolition. So this thing was orchestrated deliberately with the seating chart to make sure that the ones who were going to be really critical were put out of reach of Obama, and the ones who were going to be very, very appreciative of his visit were put in the immediate row.
Censorship from past to present. I suppose we shouldn't necessarily be surprised. We've been speaking with Peter Kuznick for the hour, award-winning author and historian, co-author with Oliver Stone of The Untold History of the United States. And Peter Kuznick, we're out of time, but you write at the end of the introduction of your book, "The Record of American Empire is not a pretty one, but it is one that must be faced honestly and forthrightly if the United States is ever to undertake the kind of fundamental structural reforms that will allow it to play a leading role in advancing rather than retarding the progress of humanity." And again, after the whirlwind of an hour here with you, there's definitely a lot we didn't get into, including the rise of the national security state. And I think you ended on a fascinating point about what's going on in Japan, and also the continued orchestration of, or the suppression of, counter-narratives.
Yes. Well, that's something that you guys have been working on, and we've been working on to challenge the traditional wisdom in this country and get the Americans back on a path where we can represent something positive in the world.
Well, Peter Kuznick, we sincerely appreciate your time, your expertise. It's always great to be in conversation with you here on the Project Censored Show. So thanks so much for joining us. We look forward to having you back on.
Anytime. Look forward to
thanks
it.
Thanks a lot, Peter.
Take care.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians. Cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear that same old thing they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rape.
And that does it for the Project Censored Show today. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips on Pacifica Radio. Special thanks today goes to Anthony Fest, our producer, also to Erica Bridgman, our engineer. The Project Censored Show airs on 35 stations around the United States, from Maui to New York. Archives can be found online at projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us, and follow updates about Project Censored on our Facebook page, Project Censored. We'll see you next time.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
CUC Radio.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Climate change is here. Now what? Professor Bill Collins. There are three surprises embedded in this headline. Climate change is here, a statement of fact, in a time of climate change denial. Combined with the question, now what? That seems to indicate a new turn for scientists who hesitated for so long to make recommendations. Also, this acknowledgement of the current situation is coming out of a venerable 75-year-old institution, the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab. They conduct scientific research on behalf of the U.S. Department of Energy. In September 2015, the Berkeley Lab established the Climate and Ecosystem Sciences Division to understand, predict, and advance stewardship of the Earth's climate and ecosystems. Professor Bill Collins is the director. He's an expert in climate change science. Professor Collins also is the director of the Climate Readiness Institute, a new multi-campus initiative to prepare the San Francisco Bay Area for climate change. As I'm recording this in June 2016, there are still very few places on Earth where academia and public policy representatives are collaborating on specific plans to respond to climate change. And that includes sea level rise, heat waves, health issues, and more. You are about to hear a lively Q&A over geoengineering, carbon intensity of food and agriculture, air pollution, and heat waves. These are excerpts from an almost two-hour event that also covered direct recommendations for the San Francisco Bay Area and, by implication, any city on the ocean. The local specifics can be found on the Berkeley Lab YouTube channel under Climate Change is Here. Now what? He is Professor Bill Collins from the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab. The moderator is Berkeley Lab's Jeff Miller.
We tend to emphasize carbon, but what we haven't discussed so far is something called the short-lived climate pollutants, soot and methane. Now methane.
Yes.
Pernicious methane.
Pernicious methane. Man is now the major source of methane in the climate system. We outrank natural sources by a factor of 2 to 1. The two dominant sources of methane in the climate system and from man are, again, from fossil fuel production recovery, for example, from coal mines, and from agricultural activities. Again, fortunately, methane has a relatively short lifetime in the Earth's climate system. It's less than a decade. And we're starting to see concerted action in the United States. President Obama has made it a central tenet of his climate action plan to get a handle on methane sources. And we've also seen action in Asia and around the world in trying to get a handle on this problem. Japan is experimenting with rice paddies, for example, that emit much less methane than traditional inundated rice paddies. So countries around the world are really facing this issue very squarely.
How does it rate with carbon in terms of its intense damage that it does?
In terms of its total impact on how much we've changed the Earth's greenhouse effect, it's a third as big as carbon dioxide. But the problem is that it's 30 times more effective pound for pound than CO2 as a greenhouse gas. In this country, we're really touting methane and natural gas as a wonderful source. It is wonderful. It produces half as much carbon dioxide per BTU as coal.
But
because of this 30 times fold intensity of its greenhouse effect, you cannot tolerate leaks in the system. And the U.S. has built an energy infrastructure around recovering and delivering natural gas that is highly leaky and is very poorly characterized. And we now know, thanks to measurements made in part at Berkeley Lab, that there's twice as much methane being emitted over the United States as EPA claimed. And we should be very grateful to EPA for having tried to characterize it, but there's twice as much there as they thought.
And what role does fracking play?
Well, we've literally reinvented the Wild West. But this time around, the gun that's facing us is not, it's a loaded gun, but it's a loaded gun that involves natural gas. I think we have to get a handle around the leaky sources of the methane and the very leaky delivery system, because otherwise the benefits from natural gas are largely offset by these leaks into the Earth's climate system. Let's just look at what happened in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. Los Angeles had a leak that equaled essentially all the cars on the streets of Los Angeles during the period when that leak was active. And this is a leak from one single reservoir of natural gas. So that sort of sets the scale of the problem for you.
Now we're going to move to one of my favorite topics. Let's talk about livestock and agriculture. So what role do feedlots play in the methane picture?
So agriculture is worldwide, including animal husbandry is one of the top three sources of methane. We're going to have to address its role as a major source of greenhouse gas. You brought up feedstocks or animal husbandry, I think, in particular on the issue of whether or not we change our food mix in the future. And I think that's something we're going to have to think about mm-hmm. very seriously. In terms of a truly sustainable mix of food that goes much easier on the land surface, goes much easier on the surrounding environments, this is, again, going to take we brought up behavioral shifts at the beginning of this conversation. Mm-hmm. I think this is going to require some major behavioral shifts. And this is a very deep-seated issue for a lot of people. I think a lot of people really like the food that they eat. I think they're going to have to think again.
Should we all become vegetarians? Is that a recommendation from this evening?
Well, I'm not going to proselytize around food. This is something that it's a very frequent thing to do in Berkeley. I'm not going to fall into that trap. Okay. I will say, I'll only speak personally around this issue. Once we entered into a water crisis, I went from being a vegetarian to vegan, mm-hmm. precisely because the water commitment to, for example, milk, which I was happy to pour in my cereal every morning, is four times bigger than that of soy milk. So what sort of flipped the switch for me to go from being a vegetarian to vegan was the issue around water. I think it's very important for us to be mindful about the impacts of the food that we eat. You know, I will also freely admit, and I'm guilty of this, as guilty as anyone else who's wandered into the fabulous grocery stores that we have here and gone and look at this vast array of food, uh-huh. much of which, you know, I don't even sure what hemisphere it's coming from. Do I care about which hemisphere it comes from before I put it in my food cart? No. Should I?
Yes.
Definitely.
Yeah.
I think one thing that would be kind of cool is if we had in our markets not only the thing that weighs the food, but a different scale that said, here's the carbon commitment. So you could take two bags of apples, right, one grown 50 miles away and another one grown in South America, and drop them on this scale and sort of look at what happens to the carbon. Wouldn't that be a cool concept in a grocery store? I think we as a public have to demand information. So one thing that we are much less cognizant of than people, for example, in London and elsewhere, is that they have really internalized the carbon commitment around every mile that they drive. And that message around the carbon commitment of how much carbon you emit for every mile that you drive your car has been deeply internalized, for example, in the UK. We need to demand that information about all of our activities so that we internalize the choices that we make and what climate impact they have, so we can make smart choices around climate impact. We have been denied that information. We have to demand it. I think once we get that information, then we need to build, you know, cohorts and communities around solutions. And I think we then have to demand that our policymakers act on this information. And the example I want to bring up is, think about how much of a third rail touching Social Security is that politicians immediately react to and steer clear from. I'm sorry to say that, unfortunately, gun control is one of those. We have to make climate change the third rail in politics. But we need to make sure that politicians recognize that they will be voted out of office in a heartbeat if they do something that's climate stupid. We need to get to the point where that is a thing.
In the Berkeley Lab tradition, I love it.
Yeah.
Do we have any questions in the audience? Please raise your hand.
I've heard that there is a lot of methane up in the Arctic that will be released as the permafrost is melted. Mm-hmm. Is that methane release incorporated into contemporary models? Because mm-hmm. I heard that it wasn't in mm-hmm. past IPCC models.
Right. So that the capability of modeling that methane has been coming online. We did a lot of research on that at Berkeley Lab. I'm proud to say that we were the first group to build a fully prognostic or predictive methane cycle for use in climate models. The challenge there is there's a huge amount of carbon stored in permafrost. It's 10 million square kilometers of frozen soil up around the Arctic Circle. According to certain estimates, twice as much carbon locked up in that permafrost as there is in the Earth's atmosphere. So the critical question is, how does that methane come out, as carbon dioxide or as methane? There are a number of groups worldwide that are now measuring this. I am happy to say that the measurements suggest that when the permafrost thaws, the majority of that carbon is coming out as carbon dioxide, not as methane. But it's still an issue. It's something that the Department of Energy and the National Science Foundation and actually all the member countries in the Arctic Council are hard at work trying to solve. And we are bringing those capabilities online in the climate model. So that's becoming a real-life capability now. But excellent question.
But when you think about the whole, the larger intellectual infrastructure and research infrastructure in the U.S., I mean, are we really aligned properly to meet this problem, or do we need to do some major structural changes in that?
No, we are not aligned properly to deal with this problem. Let me just compare and contrast the amount of money that the U.S. spends, and I don't mean to single out the U.S. on this issue, but the amount of money the U.S. spends on weapons R&D versus climate R&D. Mm-hmm. It's over a factor of 10. So the U.S. spends somewhere in the range of $70 billion a year on weapons research. And if you look at the sum total spent on climate, it's just around 6. It's a factor of 10. We should be looking at this as if this is a Manhattan Project, but a Manhattan Project with a worthy outcome, and one that's going to take a century to play out. But we need to be dedicating resources to it as if it's that scale of challenge.
I want to get back to the heat wave example just for a second, because I think what we might see when we're talking about climate equity is the possibility that in substandard housing, that's also sometimes an issue, like there was in France, massive heat waves, there could be people dying as a result of that, and that would be disproportionately happening in these underprivileged areas is what I'm assuming. So this is a serious threat.
Yes, it is a serious threat, and this is one where the climate models are in complete agreement about what's going to happen. There's really no ambiguity. The only ambiguity is that most of the climate change we're going to see between now and 2040 is already in the pipeline. What happens after 2040 is really something where we have a major choice about which path we follow. If we choose to follow business-as-usual pathway, we're going to be looking at a situation where the southern part of the United States is experiencing permanent, perpetual heat waves every summer that would be a serious threat to human health. And this is an extremely robust prediction. This, by the way, affects not only the United States, it affects China. So the Berkeley Lab has taken this result and shown it to the previous premier in China. It affects the whole Mediterranean area in Europe. It affects the whole Northern Hemisphere. So this is an issue that we have to face squarely. And again, we're sort of framing this in a human context, but we also have to think about the implications of this for ecosystems. We've sort of punched the accelerator in terms of how rapidly ecosystems have to change to meet a very different thermal environment. And some of them can't change fast enough. The humans, you know, we cohabit this planet with a really remarkable diversity of life, and we have to be mindful of the fact that we're stressing them out as well.
This is the web of life that you mentioned earlier.
Yes.
Okay, we have a question in our live audience. Yeah.
What do you think about climate engineering?
Some people have decided that we have essentially thrown in the towel and said that we should not deal with the root cause of the problem, which is emitting greenhouse gases. We should apply really, really big Band-Aids to the system. Mm-hmm. These fall into a bucket known as geoengineering. Some of them involve creating what amounts to a permanent volcano. Volcanoes cool the climate system. And so the strategy there has been to pump sulfur aerosols into the stratosphere using a fleet of 747s flying 24/7 and creating an artificial volcano. That's an example of geoengineering. There are other people who've thought about blowing sea salt into the lower Earth's atmosphere to create more clouds. Low-altitude clouds reflect sunlight. They help to cool the climate system. There are people who like to think bigger and who want to create an artificial sunspot by parking a 1,000-kilometer-wide silver-coated Mylar disc between us and the sun. So there are a range of solutions. We have to take this seriously because somebody might be tempted to think about it. I want to come back to this climate equity issue here as well.
Yeah.
So the climate community is now reluctantly looking at these solutions in terms of how effective they are, what their side effects are, how long you would need to maintain them to, this is a little bit like keeping your fingers in the dike, what things are still happening despite your attempt to engineer the way of the problem. And for the very first time in the last IPCC assessment, we presented information about that, and there's now a serious activity, ongoing activity to characterize these geoengineering solutions. None of them, for the most part, address the fact, with one possibility of carbon capture and sequestration in deep earth formations, which is, at this point, we don't know how to do on an industrial scale. None of them address the fact that, seriously address the fact that if you continue to emit carbon dioxide and you don't get rid of it, you will acidify the oceans. So reflecting sunlight does nothing about ocean acidification, and that's sticking out the bottom rung of the oceanic food chain, which is not a smart thing to do. Many of them have very nasty side consequences. And the other issue that we haven't, coming back to the climate equity issue writ large, we're very worried about people going rogue with them.
Mm-hmm.
So what if somebody decides that, you know, they, you know, they're just going, hey, this is cheap. Let's give it a whirl.
Yeah.
Without doing so in the context of an international treaty. I will give you my personal opinion.
Please.
All of them constitute a form of triage on a patient that is hemorrhaging.
Mm-hmm.
None of them are deep-rooted solutions. They are just a form of triage. I'd like to think about this problem in the same way that we faced World War II. And this is one of the reasons why I'm optimistic. As I go to museums like the Rosie Riveter Museum,
mm-hmm.
And I'd look at what the way that this country pulled together during the Second World War to face that challenge. And this was a situation where that, you know, the message around conservation and around saving and around pulling together, you know, you talk to our grandparents, and they'll describe to you what it was like to run on the same set of rubber tires for 5 years in a row and patch them. We need to get to a point where the country is facing this as a grand shared challenge, with all hands on board trying multiple things at the same time. There's not a single magic bullet. There are a few that have been identified, like externalizing the cost of carbon.
Mm-hmm.
But we need to look at this as something where we have to try a whole bunch of things. Some of them will fail. Some of them will fail spectacularly.
Mm-hmm.
But at least we'll get to a solution, and it won't be for lack of trying.
Okay. Another question from the audience.
Yes. Can you talk just a little bit more about the role of business here in the Bay Area in mm-hmm. driving solutions towards climate change here?
Part of the way that businesses can help does center on this issue around innovation. And we are really fortunate to live in a part of the country that values innovation. The lab has been a major partner in spawning a number of companies that are looking at alternative fuel sources and working very hard on growing those industries to the point, the companies to the point where they're viable. At the other end of the scale, if you look at some of the very largest companies in the Bay Area, talking about the information sector, they are acutely aware of the fact that they cannot continue to on their current curves of growth and succeed as businesses. They have to dramatically lower the energy intensity of the information services that they're providing us. And so the Googles of the world, the Intels of the world, are working extremely hard to bend the energy intensity of the information industry. That's bracketing basically all the way from extremely small startups all the way to the largest companies we have in the South Bay. They're all engaged in this. And to give you an example, the very example that's near and dear to my heart because I work with computers a lot, the computers that we would need to model climate change at the scale where we could simulate San Francisco currently would require dedicated nuclear power reactors. Gigawatt power reactors. We think we'll actually be able to deploy those with 1/50th the energy intensity by the time they come online in 10 years. And this is thanks to innovations that are being driven by companies in the South Bay. So there's a lot of good news here in terms of the innovation sector.
Okay, another question from the audience. We have time for a couple more.
I have a question for you. I'm intrigued by your idea of the magic scale that determines the mm-hmm. carbon footprint
yeah.
of items in stores.
Yes.
I realize that technologically and politically, that's probably not going to happen in the near future. But if I wanted to put together such a list, does the data exist, and where would I need to look to do it?
So there's been a lot of work done both at Berkeley and elsewhere to look at the carbon intensity of not just what we do in terms of our local activities driving, but in terms of us as consumers. And so there's no consumer carbon intensity information that's been done sort of in a, at the level of census levels. It's not terribly specific, but that information exists for the Bay Area. And you can go in and look at the consumer carbon intensity of your neighborhood thanks to these kind of tools. So these measure what we do in terms of our local commute. Mine happens to be particularly short, but they also factor in the fact that 15% of the University of California, Berkeley's carbon footprint is due to people flying, people like me, and the carbon intensity of our food. So that information is now available, fortunately.
Okay, a couple more questions.
On the subject of hopeful elements in this whole discussion, basically, are there any natural negative feedback loops? There are lots of scary positive feedback loops, but what are the, you know, what, if any, are the negative feedback loops of climate change that nature has to offer?
There are negative feedback loops. The problem is that they operate on really slow timescales. So you can go to the Grand Canyon and see a beautiful example, just walking from the rim down to the Colorado River, sort of play back the tape of climate change. And you can see the action of these climate feedbacks play out in front of your eyes. The climate feedbacks that will draw down carbon dioxide, there are some fast-acting ones, things like trees. There are longer-lived ones like the ocean. The ocean contains 50 times as much carbon dioxide as the Earth's atmosphere. That takes 3,000 years, though, to do its work. And then you've got geologic ones that take tens of thousands of years to do their work. It's thought, for example, that one of the reasons why we were able to form Antarctica, that's a feedback that took tens of millions of years to act. So there are feedbacks. That's the good news. The problem is that we have punched the accelerator in terms of introducing carbon dioxide into the Earth's atmosphere, and we're currently operating at 10,000 times what nature normally does. We're about to hit 100,000 times. So we're going to take the climate back this century, the Earth's carbon dioxide level, back to levels it hadn't seen for 30 million years. And those feedbacks just don't operate quickly enough to handle a situation where you're driving toward the cliff and you decide to floor it. So,
Okay, last question for the evening. Who will it be?
Scientists at several different universities tried to look into the carbon intensity of food and see what made the food more or less carbon intensive. Mm-hmm. And all of them came to the same conclusion that the main contributor to the carbon density was not the shipping, but the production of the food. Mm-hmm. And that, in effect, if you were to eat apples shipped from halfway around the world, it would be a far, far lower carbon intensity than if you were to eat locally grown beef.
You do have a point there. And I was trying to dodge this issue about protein selection.
We're back to vegetarianism.
Back to vegetarianism. I want to pose the same question with respect to our Pacific Rim. Look at the impacts of cultures that are devoted to fishing in a completely unsustainable way. I mean, we are as a planet going to have to shift cultural practices around food. You raise a perfectly good point. I mentioned that I went from being a vegetarian to a vegan, so imagine why I went to being a vegetarian. It's partly for that reason as well. We're really going to have to think very consciously, and frankly, we're not going to have a choice anymore about how to live sustainably on this planet. I want to, again, broaden the lens back from just what we eat, because this is a favorite topic. But we also have to think about how what we eat affects the web of life around us. We need to move to a mode where the fact that we've killed off a species is headline news above the fold on the newspaper. This has to be something where, again, we need to internalize the idea that the web of life is really precious, and the loss of a single salamander species trumps Trump.
Ah, and on that note, we will close. Thank you, audience. Thank you, Bill.
Thank you.
Thank you all. Good night.
Good night.
That was the conclusion of a one-hour program with Professor Bill Collins, Director of the New Climate and Ecosystem Science Division at the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab. Collins also is Director of the Climate Readiness Institute, a multi-campus initiative to prepare the San Francisco Bay Area for climate change. As lead author on the fourth assessment of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, Collins was a co-recipient of the 2007 Nobel Peace Prize. Thanks to the Berkeley Lab for their March 24, 2016 recording. They posted the event on YouTube at the Berkeley Lab channel under the title, Climate Change is Here. Now what? You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio is free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. For more information, call 707-463-2654 or go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org, for the address and donate buttons. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. TUC Radio takes its name from an aeronautical term. Time of useful consciousness is the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness, the brief moment in which a pilot may save the plane. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
Latin Waves with your hosts Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
There are rich deposits of education. Louis Moll calls it funds of knowledge. And I believe that these funds of knowledge, you know, are readily available within all of our communities. And these funds of knowledge can be picked up. They're valuable resources.
That's the voice of educator and author Dr. David Kirkland. On this week's show, we speak to Dr. Kirkland about a revolutionary new model of education that includes the entire culture and not just the dominant group. So stay tuned.
We're very privileged to be joined by Dr. David Kirkland. He's a transdisciplinary scholar of English and urban education, and he explores the intersections among urban youth culture, language, and literacy. As an urban teacher of preparation in digital media, he analyzes culture, language, and text, and has expertise in critical literacy, ethnographic, and sociolinguistic research methods. Very privileged to have you on our program. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Sylvia.
Now, in one of your most recent articles, Black Skin, White Mask, Normalizing Whiteness and the Trouble with the Achievement Gap, you speak about the educational gap. Can you talk a little bit about your article and how has education been synthesized? What's missing? Who is being left behind?
Well, one thing that I attempt to do in that article is challenge the notion of the education, or at least the achievement gap. I think the achievement gap is a misplaced metaphor. In a sense, the achievement gap prescribes achievement to a certain population, and that population is usually homogeneous, and the population is usually white. And that population becomes the standard by which everyone else is measured. And I find it problematic that we use that standard when talking about, you know, black and brown kids, poor kids. And it really doesn't do us much service when we think about reframing education, education for justice, but even this notion of achievement. I think there are better metaphors that can be used. So as opposed to an achievement gap, Gloria Latzing-Billings in 2006, I believe, in her ARA presidential address, in ARA as the American Educational Research Association, she uses a term called the or a phrase called the education debt. Here, we're not blaming kids for not achieving. Instead, we're blaming a system that's failing, you know, to help kids pay off on those educational funds that we owe them. And so the education debt suggests that kids aren't failing, we're failing kids.
When I think about the society we live, we are faced with economic crisis, we're faced with crisis of food, we're faced with crisis of people not being able to live in particular areas because of water, because of floods, because of things that we are calling natural disasters. And I would argue that there are no natural disasters. You know, there are people that are made vulnerable by their circumstances, by extreme poverty. How does education that negates or ignores the contextual and the intersection of poverty and the privilege that is achieved through higher education contribute to maintaining this injustice, but also this normalized way of living?
Right, right. Well, the term education is a tricky term because in a lot of circles, it's automatically seen as good. And I think there is a sentiment that you're expressing in your statement that education hasn't always been used, you know, to help people. In fact, in some ways, education is used to hold down large groups of people, whereby those people begin to consent, you know, to oppression. So if we think about education in the United States, when kids go to school, let's say, and begin to read texts like Shakespeare, they're not only learning Matthew Arnold's best that's thought and said, if you want to consider Shakespeare as the best that's thought and said. They're also learning that who can say what's best or who can think what's best, you know, are white men. And so that education typically, instead of being empowering, becomes very disabling and disempowering, where students, particular students, have to make certain choices, either choose to put on the clothes of a community and identity that doesn't feel or look like you, or choose not to and suffer the consequences of failure. And so when we begin to look at education in that sense, it's not empowering, but education can be empowering just as much as it can be oppressive. And the education that I like to think of that's empowering are the types of community education projects that happen across the United States, if not the globe, where people are beginning to learn and understand themselves and how they're situated within our multicultural democracy in ways that can motivate powerful participation. And by powerful participation, I mean education, you know, with the will to vote, education toward political enfranchisement, education toward, you know, a more nuanced sense of self, education that leads to, you know, young men, you know, thinking less misogynistically about women, young women thinking, you know, highly about themselves, education that begins to look at the ignorances that, you know, cause homophobia, xenophobia, and all the other phobias, you know, that we learn through the scripts of our society. So when we think of education, I think we have to begin to unpack that term in serious ways, because education, just as it can be touted and it can be wielded, you know, to do a lot of good, traditionally, particularly within our schools among poor and kids of color, education becomes a weapon to further their oppression.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about this relationship between oppression and how the state is implicated in the kinds of education that are pursued, the kind of education that is inculcated in the relationship between the two, the oppression of the vast majority of Black and Latinos, and the kinds of naturalization of policies like the war on drugs and things that debase our humanity as beings.
Let's look at some of the metaphors again. Like one of my favorite metaphors is this metaphor that we do with reading. And so we call urban kids who are not reading toward proficiency, we call those kids, you know, struggling readers or striving readers. And we create this very interesting set of, you know, metaphors around it. One metaphor is like reading recovery. What a base metaphor, right? Reading recovery. We got triage for these, you know, broken kids who can't read. And what that does, it gives us a deficit perspective. It gives us a negative way to begin to look at communities and situations that is institutionalized based on how we think about and talk about education. And I think that's problematic at its core. Why don't we have more enlightening metaphors like reading discovery, right, as opposed to reading recovery? Another idea, you know, we have, you know, this notion in education about disengaged readers, and we're usually talking about, you know, brown and black boys, you know, who refuse to read what's handed to them in class. And yet, when we look at these young men outside of classrooms, they're reading and writing in droves, creating text on bodies and walls, reading text through video games and other forms of, you know, textual situations. And they don't necessarily get credit in school for that type of reading, nor do they get to be called readers. And yet I think we have the adjective misplaced. It's not that they're disengaged readers because they read a lot. The reading that we have them do in school, however, is disengaging. And so instead of talking about disengaged classrooms, we filter the blame toward, you know, certain populations of people who are essentially powerless. And this is how the state becomes implicated in education. The state and the media, and I have to say the media, creates this fog where we can not see too well, you know, what's really going on. And what's really going on is that, you know, Black and brown kids, you know, while they're not achieving as highly on standardized tests, they have some of the same developmental trajectories as all kids. So the question that we have to ask is if developmentally they're consistent, if developmentally they're the same as dominant population, you know, why don't they reap the rewards of education, nor do they get, you know, considered or talked about inside of our larger public discourse in empowering ways? So instead of, you know, talking about these kids, you know, at least through state-sanctioned discourses from a deficit perspective, how can we begin to talk about them through a profit perspective?
How do we create, and for me, I think it's a part of us appropriating our own education and, you know, not only demanding but also creating a new way of educating ourselves, because it's not going to come from above. It has to be created from below. Where do we begin, and what are the opportunities that we need to grasp on?
I think we have to begin to protect some of our opportunities because before desegregation, there were instruments within, you know, communities of color where education in very empowering and rich ways happened. I think what happens is when we hand over the rights of education, we hand over the rights of what, you know, gets considered to be, you know, educational content. Not only do we hand over the rights of what gets to be considered, you know, educational content, we hand over the rights of who gets to be considered educated. Carter G. Woodson, I think, put it best. He said, if you control a man's thoughts, you don't have to worry about his actions. You don't have to send him out the back door. He'll go without being told. And if there isn't a back door for him to go out of, he'll cut one out for his own special benefit. His education makes it necessary. And to me, that says whoever controls the means, not just of production, material production, but also mental production, you know, controls the keys, right, to our communities, to our cultures and our subjectivities, ourselves and our senses of possibility for acting. I want to say this. There are rich deposits of education. Louis Malle calls it funds of knowledge. And I believe that these funds of knowledge, you know, are readily available within all of our communities. And these funds of knowledge can be picked up. They're valuable resources that we shouldn't give away cheaply, that we should hold on to, like our cultural celebrations. I was in California, May 5th, 2011, and I went to a Cinco de Mayo celebration. And it was one of the most powerful, enlightening, educative things about oppression, about colonization, about people and their inherent resilience to struggle against oppression. It was a counter-narrative to the dominant education that we got. And my only regret was that everybody in this nation, if not the world, could have been at this event to begin to understand the counter-histories that are being written, that are being celebrated and talked about. My sense is that these things are going on everywhere. My sense is that from, you know, California to Connecticut, we can find people educating, celebrating rituals, constructing and articulating counter narratives, you know, to the dominant narrative, where people of color and poor people, you know, find enfranchisement within their own communities. And they draw on their rich sources, resources, their funds of knowledge, as Louis Malle would say, or to use another esoteric term, Pierre Bourdieu's cultural capital. They do have cultural capital. The other question then becomes, how do we make, you know, local cultural capital of communities of color, historically underrepresented communities, how do we make that mass cultural capital? How do we make texts by, you know, authors like Ofelia Garcia, how do we make those texts, you know, as relevant as texts by, let's say, Shakespeare or Emily Dickinson? Because there are writers who are non-white who have put together, you know, powerful words and performances. In my own work, I've pushed, you know, popular culture in the classroom to have our students begin to discover and discuss themselves and the world through the text that makes sense to them, not necessarily the text that, you know, have made sense to, you know, our oppressive traditions. And we've seen some results. We see students more engaged when they're able to read, let's say, for instance, you know, a Tupac song in class. We see students, you know, highly engaged in criticism, literary and film and cultural criticism, when they're able to, you know, discuss a film that's popular, let's say like X-Men, where they really begin to discuss issues of intolerance. And I think that there is room for us to begin to break open, you know, the traditions, the static traditions of education, and begin to insert new stuff, stuff that's already happening on the ground in our communities, that are part of our, you know, community and cultural resources, our cultural education, our cultural identities. And I think it's up to us, as you said, to begin to enforce that conversation.
Ferry talks about learning to read the word in order to read the world. How do you engage your students? For instance, through hip-hop, you talk in your writing how by not only connecting to what they are interested in, there are opportunities. Can you give us an example or some of the stories that most dominant curriculum texts ignore or are not covering?
In order to fully understand the world and be removed from the systems and cycles of oppression that can coincide with education, we have to become critical consumers of the universe. We have to develop a consciousness, and that consciousness develops around understanding our position in the world, beginning to name things like oppression and points of oppression in order to articulate a response to those things, to those items. One thing that we do in some of my work, I have a curriculum called Teaching Tupac, and we listen to the to rap lyrics. We listen to the lyrics of rappers from Tupac to Lil Wayne, and we try to understand deeply what they're saying as cultural critics, people who have used their textual ability, their education, to begin to describe some of the conditions of our world. And then we analyze, much like you would any other text, you know, the points that they're making, whether or not those points, you know, first we try to understand what they're saying, and then analyze the points that they're making. You know, and I argue that a lot of generative work can come from this process of reflection and action, this process of deep reading and analysis and applying that analysis to life. So, for instance, Tupac, in one of his songs, Keep Your Head Up, he talks about women who are on welfare. He goes, Tupac cares if don't nobody else care, which becomes a very interesting, you know, counter-narrative to the dominant narrative of our culture, because the argument is that women who are on welfare, you know, are lazy, right? Or they are welfare queens, people, you know, who are sexually vivacious or worse, sexually promiscuous, you know, in the most degenerative ways. Well, when Tupac says it, he honors, I give a holla to my women on welfare. So his narrative isn't that these women are, you know, derogatory or bad in any way, but to the contrary, in some ways they should be honored. They're doing what they can, you know, to raise the next generation. They're doing what they can to help people out. So from that reflective stance of reading hip-hop and reading the text that's very real and very relevant to our students, you know, we begin to move toward action points. And this is where Paulo Freire's notion of praxis comes into play, because not only are we reflecting on the world, we're also acting on the world. And the acting on the world, you know, is pivoted toward, you know, change toward improvement. And that improvement is, you know, locating an issue like oppression and beginning to rewrite it. These students in this one particular class that read Tupac's Keep Your Head Up and began to talk about, you know, his treatment of women, you know, as compared to society's treatment of women, a particular type of woman, women who are on welfare. They had a holiday, not a welfare woman's holiday, but a mother's holiday that was different than Mother's Day. It became a day where the school and students celebrated, you know, women. They brought in texts by women. They wrote stories about mothers, you know, and the power of motherhood. And both men and women did it alike. Mothers came in and shared their stories, and it became a deep day of devotion. What it did was it changed our consciousness around motherhood, and it changed our consciousness around the location of women, you know, around that concept. They articulated a counter narrative, if you will, you know, to this notion of welfare. And then we began to see that welfare wasn't just a system of dependency and assistance that people who are marginal, at least economically marginal in our society, welfare is the care and the love that our mothers give us in situations of great struggle and sometimes, you know, despondency and desperation. And it became a beautiful day and a beautiful commentary on our humanity. And so just by beginning to read some of those books, students are beginning to make those connections to the world and changing the world, so much so that they can articulate and call out their own holiday.
Many of the classes that we see our students participate in are furthering the biases against youth, the narrative of who is the criminal, who is the deviant in society. How do we overcome that narrative? Because a lot of that, I think, is also self-internalized, and we repeat and re-inscribe ourselves with those labels.
Right, right. I think that there are mechanisms within the school and the school industrial complex that lead to the prison industrial complex. I have friends who write about the school-to-prison pipeline, and it's very real. Ann Ferguson says that just as schools, you know, track some to be doctors and lawyers, it tracks others to be prisoners. And we see this when we go into schools. Detentions are, you know, usually held in basements where there are no windows. And these places look like, you know, prison facilities. The punitive damages are disproportionately handed out to, you know, males of color. And so we see a lot of those things, you know, from suspension and dropout and, you know, other categories that are associated with school reflected in, you know, who gets a job and society and who doesn't, who gets to stay out of prison and who doesn't. And so these things are very real. In terms of solutions, what can we do? I think we have to take more of an active role in how our youth in our communities, youth in our homes, experience school and society. Again, I want to go back to points about, you know, metaphors, because you're right. There are some points of self-fulfilling prophecy where if the narrative that you get from society is that you're not worth it or you're not much, you know, you're going to begin to believe it. And not only are you going to begin to believe it, you're going to begin to behave it. And when you begin to behave it, you know, it's not much that can happen. So we have to begin to work at that level and that moment of belief, right, where you begin to believe that you're a problem. Du Bois in The Souls of Black Folk, he asks a very interesting question. I think it's a pivotal question to, you know, this conversation and the question that you raised. And that is, what does it feel like to be a problem? And that's how our students go to school almost every day. They go to school crumbling buildings sometimes. Sometimes hopping over bodies, either homeless bodies or bodies that have been laid to sleep with a lot on their mind, stress. And I'm talking about post-traumatic stress, right? And so some of our students have, you know, post-traumatic stress syndrome going to schools, impressing those beliefs that they can't make it, those beliefs that they are a problem. And we have to let them know that they're not the problem. Again, that the deficit discourse that we place on them, we have to begin to peel it apart and put in its place a profit perspective, one that says that they can't, that the problem, if there is a problem, it's not them. The problem is the crooked society that we have erected around them. And if we've erected a crooked society around them, then it's up to us to begin to pull that society down. I like to use an analogy. Let's say success is in a gated fortress. The fortress is huge and close to impenetrable. It has gates that keep some in, those who succeed, and keep some out, those who don't succeed. One articulation of the solution is to give those who are outside the gate keys so they can get in. However, there's only a certain amount of keys to be distributed. So let's say we have 100 people outside. We only have 5 sets of keys to give to those people. So 95 people have to stay outside, but only 5 people can make it in. And so we got the 100 people beating themselves up over keys so they can make it in. Another solution would be then to throw away the keys. Take those 100 people and begin to tear the gates down to the fortress so that everybody can make it in. It's not just about access to, you know, to the education system that we have right now. It's not just about access to something that doesn't work for our people. It's about tearing that thing down and erecting something else in its place, something that will house all of us equally. And I think that's where the work starts, somewhere between helping our students to believe in themselves from a profit perspective, in working to break down those things, those gated places that keep youth out, that keep youth away from fulfilling great potential. If we do have a goal in education, if we do have a goal in social justice, if we do have a goal in terms of transformative theory, that goal has to do with possibility. And that goal has to do with, you know, if we're going to have self-fulfilling prophecies, those self-fulfilling prophecies should be empowering prophecies.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much for being with us. My guest is Dr. David Kirkland. You have a book coming up, Search Past Silence.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about it?
It's a book with Teachers College Press, and it's a narrative of 6 young men that I studied in Michigan, again, around this notion that, you know, some people are literate and other people aren't. And I wanted to challenge, well, at least these young men, for me, challenge that notion that some men were literate or some people are literate and some people aren't. I think some literacies are recognized and some literacies aren't. And these young men's literacies weren't recognized. So what I wanted to do is show various points in their lives where language, words and stories, syntax and vocabulary became very powerful points of articulation where they found themselves and they located themselves within a larger world. And it ends with the question, if they are human, if they are to be humanized, why can't we educate them? Why can't we respect what they bring to classrooms too? And so the search past silence is, you know, searching past some of our quiet assumptions, discriminations, prejudices about certain people toward those places of compassion and tolerance and even more respect, where we become a human community guided by the goodwill of, you know, our humanity. And it's not just for, you know, populations of color. I've argued that, you know, white students and a homogeneous, you know, white population, middle-class population can learn just as much, you know, from studying rap music in class as an urban, you know, kid, you know, who happens to be poor and of color. And they may learn different things, and those different things they learn, you know, may be more important for them to learn, because the world is becoming more and more cosmopolitan, we're becoming more global, and there's points of contact that we're making. And then there's the conversation about our humanity. If this education that I'm articulating is about heightening our humanity, then why shouldn't it be for everybody?
Thank you so much for being with us. How can people access your book?
It comes out with Teachers College Press. I have a few other books, Change Matters, which is on Amazon, Narratives of Social Justice Teaching. It's also on Amazon.
Thank you again for being with us.
Thank you, Sylvia.
Take care. We have come to the end of our program. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program available to campus and community radios. Please visit our website, www.latinwavesmedia.com, to hear previous shows, connect to our media projects, and access other resources, or to support our efforts by making a safe PayPal contribution. I am Sylvia Richardson. Thanks for listening.